Okay, let's rise. I'm going to ask the man closest to the flag to say the pledge. Mr. Griffith.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. We have the agenda before us. It has been suggested that we move audience participation up before the city council member comments. Is there objection to that? It's thinking as there might be somebody in the audience that wants to speak to the assembly before we move on. And assumption is that cities will be free to leave after the city council member comments. Anything else on the agenda? If there's no objections, that'll be our business for the night. And we have one item of joint business, and that's consolidated dispatch. And we'll ask Dennis to kick off that presentation. Dennis Brodigan.
My name is Dennis Brodigan. I'm the Director of Emergency Services for the Mat-Su Borough. Earlier this year, we went out to RFP to secure a consultant firm to come up and do a feasibility study for the consolidation of the two dispatch centers, an E911 center here. After months of gathering data and interviewing everybody across the board, the agency ADCOM Engineering of Bothell, Washington, has put together their findings and their recommendations, and that's what we're here for tonight. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Mr. Joe Blaska. He's a project manager for this, and he can introduce his team and continue on with the findings and recommendations.
Good evening, everyone. It's too bad we can't have this outside. The nice weather has been raining for a few days, and so we have a nice evening here. So we'll hopefully it'll be dark by the time we're done, so I guess we won't be able to enjoy it anyway. I'd like to say we brought the nice weather up from Seattle, but if you've ever been to Seattle, you know that that doesn't always happen real well either. So we'd like to thank the borough and the citizens and the other agencies for the opportunity to do this study. It was an interesting study. It was a challenging study, given the nature of the area, the size of the borough, nature of the population. But I think that we got a good handle on the situation, and I think you'll enjoy the findings. Part of the presentation will be done as we move forward. It will be done by Dave Magnanette and Keith Flewelling. They are sort of the subject matter experts on different portions of the report, so they will speak to those specifically. The report, there is a copy of excerpts, of an excerpt of the report that's been handed out. We ask that the full report not be handed out as it's in draft version right at this point. You know, there's a few some wordings that need to be clarified. There's a couple of typos, and as a result of the review of the report, there were some minor number changes in terms of some of the call counts and some things like that that we'll correct. None of that information changes any of the substance of the report, however, at this point. So as soon as we get feedback and we make those changes, then the final report will be released. Now here's the tricky part, right? Make sure I can make the AV work.
While you're confirming that, we'll just note for the record that Assemblymember Solomon arrived at 6:04. Thank you.
So this just to do a brief executive summary of what's in the report. The 911 call processing here in the borough is, as we found, overly complex, leading to lower customer service. And we talked about customer service. We're talking about two types of customer service here. One is to the citizens of the borough who are actually making the 911 calls, and the other is to the first responders. So there's two aspects of it. So it's not just to the citizens, nor is it just to the first responders. and it increases the higher potential for error. We'll talk a little bit in more detail exactly how the call processing goes so that people will have a better understanding of that as we go through the report. The population in the borough is, as everybody knows, shouldn't be any surprise, is growing, as well as the call volume is growing, and that will force at some point some operational and structural changes in 911 dispatch. Things are going, they're sort of, calls are being handled now, but any number of things could happen, particularly, you know, I know there's a lot of discussion about, you know, the bridge down at the south end of the borough. That goes in there to be a potentially big change. But even without that, there are some significant population projections and changes that will occur over the next decade or two. Staff utilization region-wide is not optimized. We're going to talk about that in a little bit more detail as we go on in the report. And consolidating can address all of these issues. As we go through the report, you'll see that there's a pretty significant improvement in call processing time and call processing flow if you were to consolidate. And the funding exists today, or a funding approach exists today to be able to do this. The legal framework exists in state law. That was one of the big questions that came up is, you know, can we come up with a way to consolidate, and will state law allow that? Based on our research, the framework for that exists. The technical barriers are minimal. So one of the actually advantages with consolidation here is because of the use the integration of the ALMR system, the Alaska Land Mobile Radio System, as well as the way the radio consoles are configured and the 911 phone system, there's very few really technical barriers that would raise a problem. And in fact, as time goes forward, you'd reduce some of those costs, some of the costs of maintaining systems. The Department of Public Safety and AST involvement is very important to the success of the project. And our recommendation is that there be consolidation, increase automation. We're going to talk about that a little bit, the way the automation is deployed today could be improved, and you'd end up with better staff utilization. So one of the things that are really critical in any kind of a consolidation study is that you really figure out what's going on today, what some of the impacts are, and what will drive the potentials for changes. So one of the things that really should drive any consolidation study is what is the impact on customer service. And as I said before, customer service means not just to the citizen who calls 911, but also to the first responder who's out there responding to that 911 call and quite often is out there by themselves or has limited resources, at least in the initial call. What are the impacts of growth? In a very few places around are going to be stagnant growth. Your area, as evidenced, has got significant growth and will continue to have significant growth in the area, and that is something that needs to be addressed. As much as, I think it goes without saying, it's always better to try to plan for the growth ahead of time and get ahead of the curve instead of being behind the curve. Consolidation will allow you to do that. There's certainly, we wanted to look and determine what the legal authority was for consolidation, how that would handle, what the costs were, because everybody is always concerned about cost. There's a big issue that came up about PERS and about how to handle the retirement program, you know, with the employees, if the employees were to form into, or the organization were to form into a new organization or employees were to transfer. We did a lot of research on that, and the report talks about those issues. And then as you move forward into consolidation, there's a lot of issues about how do you govern the system. Do you end up with a single entity running it? Do you end up with a separate entity running it? What kind of space do you need? What are the technical efficiencies? And what are some of the approaches to implement? So the report covers all of those items, and we'll talk about those in more detail as we move forward in the report.
We'll note for the record that Council Member Best arrived, 6:10.
Thanks. I'm Dave Magnanet with ADCOM Engineering. I'm going to talk about the current state, so what's happening in the borough today, and bridge a little bit into what we see as a consolidation model. Keith will go into some more detail, and then Joe will come back to kind of put a cap on it, and happy to take questions at that point. So right now today in Mat-Su, we've got two management structures. We've got two facilities that are serving the same purpose. There's two staffs that are doing the same jobs. Two CAD systems, and this is computer-aided dispatch systems, are performing the same functions, but they don't talk to each other. The CAD tool, and you'll hear that term a lot tonight, CAD is the primary tool for handling events and incidents that occur from a dispatch perspective. So that's where dispatchers track what's going on. They track who's assigned to the call, what the outcome of the call was, and so forth. There is a shared 911 telephone system, which is terrific. That's a big benefit to everybody in the borough. We've got situations, as I'll illustrate here in a moment, where some 911 callers basically have to tell their story twice in order to get assistance because of the way calls are routed. There is a potential for uncoordinated responses, and this occurs when emergency medical might be dispatched to a location where law enforcement has also been dispatched, but because they're dispatched by two different agencies, there's the potential that they may not know each other are responding. And then we've also then got a potential here for communication breakdown because, as I'll illustrate here, I think on the next slide, there's some transferring that happens back and forth. There's some discussion that has to happen between the two comm centers. Let me back off just a second here and give you sort of an overview of where we are in the borough. Palmer Police Department has a dispatch center that is a division of the Palmer Police. They dispatch for Palmer Police Department. Mat-Su Borough has a contract with Palmer to dispatch fire, EMS, and rescue units. So in your mind, Palmer PD and fire EMS are dispatched by Palmer. At City of Wasilla, they have a dispatch organization called MATCOM, and MATCOM is a division of the Wasilla Police Department. They dispatch for Wasilla Police Department, and then the Department of Public Safety for the state dispatch has a contract with MATCOM to dispatch Alaska State Troopers. And just in case you're not aware, you probably are, but if a law enforcement event happens that is outside one of the two cities, it's an unincorporated area, then Alaska State Troopers have responsibility for law enforcement in those areas. Right, so I just wanted to give you that picture so you have an idea there. Here's a diagram of what happens when somebody calls 911, what the thought process are, what the decisions are, what the workflow is. And I'd like to run you through kind of a typical scenario for a 911 call. So, and I'm sorry, I'm going to want to point here, so I'm going to kind of have to turn my back a little bit, so please forgive me for that. So let's say, unfortunately, nationwide, one of the most common calls that we get at 911 is a domestic violence call. So I'm going to illustrate that for you so you can see how the call flows or potentially flows. So let's say things start off with a female caller dials 911 and says, my husband has assaulted me. I'm not injured, but my husband's assaulted me. Now, Palmer is designated as what's called the primary PSAP, or the primary public safety answering point. So what that means is, any 911 call in the borough is first answered by Palmer. Palmer PD evaluates some information about where that call is occurring. So in our scenario, let's say that this is happening in a remote area near Talkeetna. Both parties are still in the house. There are weapons in the residence, but the weapons are not in use. And these are typical questions. Palmer asks them. Every good dispatch center in the country asks that, the same sorts of centers. Questions. So Palmer would find out where that call is happening. It's happening in Talkeetna. Well, Palmer doesn't dispatch police for Talkeetna. That's an AST responsibility. So Palmer would then transfer the call over to MATCOM. So what we've done here is we've determined, was the call routed correctly? Just as an aside, sometimes because of the way cellular telephones work, some calls that are intended for Anchorage, that call might hit a tower here in the borough. So sometimes they get calls that are really intended for Anchorage. So that's one of the first questions they ask. So then they said, well, what kind of help is needed? Well, I need law enforcement. Okay. Where do you need law enforcement? And so the question for Palmer is, do they need law enforcement in Palmer or do they need it somewhere else? Our answer in this scenario is they need help somewhere else. So they transfer the call to MATCOM. MATCOM picks up the call and says, what help do you need? So as I said before, sometimes the caller has to repeat the request a couple of times. They determine then, is it law enforcement only? Is it EMS fire plus law enforcement? In this example, it's just law enforcement. So they will determine whether it's Wasilla or somewhere else. If it's somewhere else, then they'll dispatch Alaska State Troopers. They find out here again, because 911 calls evolve, they're not a static thing. It's not unusual for somebody to first call and say, no, I don't need aid. It's just a fight and we're upset but we're separated and we're not injured. It's not unusual for those to then turn into a request for EMS. Maybe the person realizes that they've been injured which is typically the case. So in that situation then, if a need for aid develops, then MATCOM then has to transfer the information back to Palmer so that EMS can be dispatched. The other very common driver for that sort of transfer back is if law enforcement gets on the scene and sees that there is a need for aid, they'll call for aid. Okay? So this one person who's called has been transferred at least once because where they called, they need the help somewhere else. Every time there's a transfer here, as we go through this complicated situation, every time there's a transfer, we're relying on a telephone system, but we're also changing who's actually handling the call. So we've got a lot of people involved in this. It's like maybe you've played the game Telephone, where you start at one end of the room and say a phrase, and it goes around and goes around, and it gets changed as things happen. So when we talk about the potential for a communication breakdown, that's really what we're talking about. This sort of back and forth between additional centers would not happen if there's only one center. Remember I said that the CAD systems don't talk to each other. So even though Palmer might put something into the system when the lady first calls, something like domestic violence at some address in near Talkeetna, transferred to MATCOM and closed that out. The folks over at MATCOM don't have access to that information. So when they call back for an EMS call over to Palmer, then they have to sort of go through that whole process all over again. And as I said, where there's a potential for an uncoordinated response, as AST is being sent by MATCOM, there's no update to Palmer as to where they are, so they can't tell EMS where AST is. So what that means is you have the potential for medical to show up on the scene and be ready to go in and help, but they can't because the scene isn't safe. So they'll stand off, they'll stage, and any sort of update as to where law enforcement's response is has to happen through the radio and the phone system and about five people. So the typical question when EMS gets on the scene in this scenario is, what's their ETA? What's their estimated time of arrival? In our example, EMS on the scene or staging the scene would say to Palmer, what is AST's ETA to the scene? That's a transmission that happens on the radio. Palmer picks up the phone and calls MATCOM and says, hey, what's AST's ETA to the scene? The call receiver at MATCOM calls over literally across the room to MATCOM, AST's dispatcher, and says, hey, what's AST's ETA to the scene? That's verbal in the room. The dispatcher then gets on the radio to AST, asks the responding trooper, what is the ETA? The answer comes back, I'm 5 minutes away. Then it goes backwards. So the AST dispatcher, the dispatcher tells the MATCOM call receiver AST is 5 minutes away. The call receiver tells Palmer that they're 5 minutes away. Palmer gets back on the radio and tells EMS ASTETA is 5 minutes away. So what we have is 8 steps, 5 different people involved in this conversation, and at least 3 different kinds of communication media, telephone, radio, and face-to-face. So it's complex. It's more, though, than just the customer service. There's a financial piece to talk about. And right now, borough-wide, about $3.5 million was spent annually in 2012 to provide this kind of service. Now, I want to give a little caveat here. Both of the comm centers that we worked with, plus the borough, terrific with giving us information and data and budgets and so forth. Because both of the comm centers are actually part of a larger organization, it's not possible to get all of the true costs pulled out. So, for example, some of the budgets that we got would not have things that a consolidated center would have to have costing. Human resources costs, legal costs, risk management, facility maintenance, power, light, those kinds of things. So the $3.5 million is what's budgeted and what's noted in those specific budgets. The true cost of that, as you pull it out, will be higher because, of course, in a consolidated center, those costs are real and have to be dealt with. We spent a lot of time chatting with dispatchers and stakeholders, responders, elected officials, lots of folks. Overall, the thing we heard over and over and over again in terms of a driver for change is our call volume is going up, and why does somebody have to say the same story twice? Why does a person who's calling in, why does the level of service that they get depend on where in the borough they're calling from? Why is that? How come there's not just one center? So that's a big one for us. The higher call volume due to the population increases was a big driver, we think, for change. That's going to get even trickier because, of course, as Joe mentioned, the areas of growth are in those unincorporated areas, which you'll remember are being dispatched by somebody different than the folks who are dispatching EMS. Radio console upgrades, Joe talked a little bit about that. Right now there are 12 positions, so 12 desks, if you will, throughout the borough. As changes are made to the radio consoles or to the different CAD systems or to the telephone systems and so forth, that's 12 overall positions that you have to deal with. As Keith will explain, we're suggesting a smaller number of positions overall. Duplicated efforts. Again, having to tell the same story twice, typing in the same information into 2 different CAD systems that don't talk. That's an example. We found some workflow process inefficiencies and tool problems. Right now, there's a lot of manual entry and double entry and triple entry being done by dispatchers. So, for example, cars reported stolen. That information is put into the CAD system. It's then the dispatcher literally turns to one of her 4 keyboards connected to 4 different computers and types them into different records management systems. Okay? There's a lot of time spent in that double and triple entry among your dispatch employees here in the borough. When we talk about automation, that's what we're talking about. Should be one type, type it in once, and have the systems share the information across. And that's very common, not only in CAD systems, it's common in communication centers across the country. We have a concern also about what we consider to be marginal fire and EMS major incident support. So here's what this means. At Palmer, there's between 2 and 3 people on duty at a time, usually 2, one person working law enforcement, one person working fire and EMS. And that works really well for much of the time. Our concern, though, is if there's a major apartment or a commercial structure fire at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and there are 2 folks on duty, they're going to be absolutely swamped with telephone calls. There could be law enforcement involvement as well, as we're dealing with traffic and other notifications. All at the same time, while the fire dispatcher is trying to get all of the units notified, that is a recipe for being overwhelmed very, very quickly. So we would like to see more beefed up or at least some flexible coverage so that if the major incident, let me check that, when the major incident occurs, there's some backup for that fire and EMS person so that they're not completely overwhelmed. We also found in both centers that there is less than 24/7 supervision. There have been some recent improvements in this. However, there are still not a supervisor on duty 24/7 in either communications center. 911 centers, and I have spent my life in them, 911 centers are one of the major sources of liability complaints and one of the highest risks statistically that you can have in a center, because it's one of the government operations that deal directly with life and death issues. One bad liability claim and you could really be in trouble. So that's why we think supervision is absolutely critical. Additionally, you'll see in our recommendation that increasing the supervision level also gives you, or at least begins to help you fill in, that major incident support. So to have a supervisor on duty is not only good for liability, but also when that big one hits, he or she can switch and begin to assist with some of the notifications and some of the unit traffic and that sort of thing that happens during a major incident. A couple of other items I wanted to just touch on. One is I'm going to hit again with the CAD system problems. We've got some support issues with CAD systems. In both Palmer, less with Wasilla, MATCOM, they've got a dedicated resource there. But there's also some duplicated issues, or some duplicated effort there as well. The geographic information systems are generated centrally by the borough. And these are the maps and the map information that really makes the CAD system run. That's the data that is so critical to determining who to send to a particular emergency. So it's really important that it be accurate. And because there are two different systems, what happens is the borough generates the GIS information and then sends it out to both locations. But both of the CAD systems, because they're different and not connected, have to have some adjustments and some tweaks done. And loading that information from the general store into the particular CAD systems doesn't always go real smooth. We talk a little bit in the report about the reliance at one of the comm centers on a wall map, for example. So literally the dispatchers can't use the CAD system mapping stuff. They have to actually get up and go consult a map to figure out what area and what fire department, what EMS unit to run. And that's a big liability because you've spent a lot of money on that particular CAD system, and for, you know, I'm sure what are very good reasons, it's not being used. So we think that's a real problem. So here's what the communication flow and the decisions would look like under a consolidated dispatch center. A lot fewer boxes, a lot fewer lines, which makes me as a process person happy to see. Same call. The first question still is going to be, was the call routed properly? So in other words, am I getting a call from Anchorage or somewhere outside of the borough where where I can't do anything about it? What help is needed? Law and EMS, law only, fire EMS. In a consolidated center, you'd have somebody dedicated for fire EMS, somebody dedicated for law enforcement, somebody dedicated for call receiving, supervision, and so forth. They'd be sharing a CAD system as well as a telephone system, so the situational awareness that's so important is readily available. And also, frankly, if I've got a question, all I've got to do is look over at my partner and say, hey, what's ASTCTA? A whole lot simpler. I'm running a little bit long, so let me just run quickly through this ETA piece here. Here's the same conversation in a consolidated center. We're down to six steps, two pieces of telecommunication media, and two people. So it's pretty considerable. I'm going to ask Keith to come up and talk a little bit more about some of the details of what a consolidated center in Matsubara would look like.
Good evening. My name is Keith Llewelling, and I'm really pleased to have participated in this study. As others have mentioned earlier, it was a challenging study, and it was also very enlightening for us to take a look at the situation. What I want to talk about is to explore the consolidated center a little bit further. Earlier, Dave mentioned that currently we have 12 positions. In the Consolidated Center, we're looking at the need for only six positions, active positions. Those six positions would cover the functions of call intake, so answering the telephone calls, the 911 callers. It would provide for a city dispatch, a city police dispatch position. It would provide for an AST dispatch position. It would provide for a data position. And the data position in a comm center is the position that looks up the license plate numbers and does the wants and warrants for field officers when they call in. Very important position that can save a lot of time for field personnel, and it also ensures that there's proper information flow from the dispatch center and to the field. And then also we would provide a fire and EMS position for dispatching of fire and medical resources. And then the sixth position would be that supervisor's position. So in total, we would have six staff positions and for part or all of the day. And then we would stand up or have available two fully equipped spare positions in the event of a high demand incident or a high demand ongoing incident for days where you'd have to stand up, call in extra help. So you'd have those two positions available for expansion. The Consolidated Center would be located in a new or renovated building, and we're going to talk about that, or it's talked about in the study. And there are some sites available, and we've done some work with that. But most importantly, in the new position, in the new Consolidated Center, we want to make sure that we're hiring the most valuable assets in the system. And the most valuable assets in this system are the personnel who do the work. And if you talk to the folks who manage dispatch centers, they will tell you that this is a highly skilled position that you can't learn in school. This is a position that you learn largely on the job, and those resources that you've taken up to a year to train are very valuable to the system. So we're recommending that in a consolidated center, we retain the valuable assets that you have in the system in those employees, and then hire additional employees as necessary. And then the last part here is that we want to emphasize again that this consolidated center operates on one computer-aided dispatch system so that there is one central computer. It's collecting all the information, and it's dispersing all the information to all the other databases that require that information. Further, we want to talk about the management structure of a consolidated center. And this is very important to make sure that we have the supporting cast to make sure that the frontline folks are supported in their duties. So we would recommend a director, an executive director. We'd recommend a technical systems manager who would also be responsible for all CAD management. And then we'd recommend an operations manager and an executive assistant. Now, the executive assistant is a very important position. It may not seem so on the surface, but this position is really a utility player for the organization. There's going to be accounts payable. There's going to be accounts receivable. There's going to be billing activities that will occur. There's going to be other sundry kind of clerical and administrative jobs that the executive assistant would be responsible for. So we feel that's a very important component of the consolidated center. Some of the services that the center will require, at least initially, can be contracted with some of your entities, from some of your entities, to get the organization stood up and operating functionally until they have proper funding or staffing to take on those functions themselves. So as Joe will talk about in our consolidation in place recommendation, Some of these services we will have to contract with existing entities to get us started up. Initially, we are recommending that we consolidate in place and that we migrate to a single facility at a later time. The important issue of consolidation in place is that it gets the ball rolling in the right direction. It also starts the momentum to replace the two existing CADs with one CAD, one computer-aided operating system, so that we can start to consolidate as you've done with the telephone system. So that will continue the momentum. We are also recommending in the study that we form a public not-for-profit corporation. And this is a standalone organization that will be responsible for the consolidated dispatch center. And it's provided for under Alaskan law, the 911 communications law talks about municipalities forming an independent agency. And it's actually a public not-for-profit corporation formed under the law and under the corporation laws that govern nonprofits. It also would be set up under IRS 501c3, section 115, which is really talks to quasi-governmental nonprofit organizations. Now, that's very important that it be formed under those auspices because this will play a key role when we enter into those PERS discussions. So if it's classified as a quasi-governmental organization, a corporation, then you have a better chance with the PERS folks in transferring that liability from existing city and borough to the new organization. So that's why we're recommending a public not-for-profit. Let me just talk a little bit further about the funding that it may require or will require. And this is interesting because you have a lot of the funding in place at certain levels right now within the borough. So the funding largely or in part is coming from an E911 surcharge on all telephone access devices in the borough, and your current rate is at $1 per device, and that was recently raised from 75 cents. And so we explored the possibility of raising it to the maximum provided by the Alaskan law, which is $2 per device. That level of funding will go a long way to help the organization cover all of the operations costs. But it won't cover all of the operations costs. And so the next step is to figure out what is left over after you've determined what level of surcharge you want to place on those users in the borough, and then pursue other sources of revenue to fund the organization. And at your disposal, there are many sources. For example, the capital costs could be covered by general obligation bonds, or revenue bonds can be sought for operational costs that you are going to get revenue in the coming year to pay back those bonds. You can look to grants, as the borough has been very successful in the past, and all of the municipalities have been very successful in getting grants federal and statewide. And then there's general fund appropriations that could be sought from the state, the borough, or the cities, and, of course, federal earmarks. And so there are a number of sources. So once you set about the task of trying to fund the organization, the first thing to do is to look at the surcharge and what level you want to charge. The second thing to do is to look for other sources of revenue, and then the last thing to do is to figure out an allocation formula to assess the fees
to the stakeholder organizations who are going to participate in the new consolidated center. And it sounds simple when I say that, but it's a long, tedious process, and I'm sure many of you are smiling at me right now. I want to back up a little bit and let you know that on the surcharge issue, there are four other entities in the state of Alaska who already charge the maximum $2 per device, and your neighbors in Anchorage are at $1.50. So there is precedence in the state for raising it up to $2. You would not be the first entity to do that. And with that, I'm going to let Joe come back and talk about more specifics with the consolidation.
So that once the organization, you move forward with that, there's several things that you really need to do to get the organization going that are critical. And it's also important to get all of the stakeholders and all the players involved in that process, because one of the things that makes an independent entity and or organization successful is that not only does everybody feel that they are able to participate, but they feel that they can participate in a meaningful way and that somehow or another they're not getting the short end of the stick. So of course, one of the things is, what is the organization's mission? And you want to keep this limited. We don't want all of a sudden the organization to start, people go, well, it can be a 911 center. Oh, well, maybe they can do technical support for something else, and then maybe they can do something else, and then their emergency management. So you want to focus the organization's mission as narrow as possible on what it's actually going to be incorporated to do. You need to set up the board of directors membership. A lot of times, this would be possibly elected officials, or there might be multiple levels of board of directors, and a lot of times these are the people that, have the purse strings, and we don't want to be able to have their input on that. Then, one of the main points is about any organization like this is people want to feel that they have some measure of control to be able to affect changes in what their mission is. So, for example, an example might be the Alaska State Fair in Palmer, right? So all of a sudden, maybe you need more resource capability for dispatch to handle the additional calls that are coming in. So the issue is, who pays for those, right? Somebody's paying for them today if you do that, or maybe nobody's paying for it, and sort of buried in the cost. But if there's a cost associated with that, for example, that gets charged back to the fair for additional law enforcement support, additional emergency medical support, then you can also then build in a fee structure so that the cost for those additional dispatch resources are defined, they're predictable, and if somebody comes to the dispatch center and says, I need an extra dispatcher to work at least during the fair hours, you can turn to that person and say, okay, it's this many dollars, an hour. And they can predict then exactly what those costs are going to be. And this is really critical for any entity. It's critical for Alaska State Troopers. It's critical for fire. It's critical for the entities. I mean, as you move forward, you may find that there will be other things that cities want to do, have special events, and they need additional resources. So, but of course, the other part of that, though, is you don't want to have every time there's a car accident, you don't want to have to turn to the city and say, well, here's a bill because we had to bring somebody in for 2 hours because of this car accident or this apartment fire. So part of that is to build some sort of a threshold in so that certain levels, so I guess if you have your normal emergencies, right, then those are covered. But if you have special events or things like that, then those would be, there'd be a fee structure for those. So that's a really critical thing to work out, because that's what, one of the things when you consolidate, people are always afraid of losing control. And so this is a way to build some of that back in so they can have the flexibility that they need to complete their mission as well as work that into the structure of the organization. So voting rights are critical, and this is something you'll have to work out, right? So how does this work? Does everybody have an equal vote? Do some people have more vote than others? Do you vote by how much you fund? This is something that will have to be worked out by the group. If you look at 10 different consolidated centers, you'll see 12 different ways. No, you'll see, you know, probably a half a dozen different ways for that to occur. So it's important that's be set up as well. And that's a decision that the group that's setting this up can do. Considering allow contract agencies in addition to owners. So, for example, let's say that the school district decided that they wanted to be able to have school resource officers if they had their own law enforcement or some other entity like that. You know, could be the federal government, could be any number of entities that come in and say, well, we'd really like to be part of your dispatch organization. We only maybe need, you know, have 4 or 5 calls a day. We don't really want to be an owner, so you can set up a structure so that people can be a contract entity. And then, of course, the center will own assets, and you have to figure out how those are going to get purchased, who's going to own those, and how all that's going to work out. And then buy-in and buy-out provisions. So, for example, let's say that somebody decides later on, maybe a new entity is formed, maybe this is the federal government, they come in and they want to buy in and they want to be a participant in the dispatch center. How do they buy in, and how does that cost then, let's say, the original founders then get reimbursed for those costs? What if an entity decides for whatever reason to leave, and what are those buyout provisions? Do they, you know, what costs are they structured with? How do they do that? What are the notices? All those kinds of things have to be handled as well. All of these are standard provisions. We've done lots of consolidated centers. These things all get worked out. Everybody, there is no standard. I mean, the process is pretty standard, but there's no standard results. Every entity, every different set of agencies comes up with a different way of doing things that are unique to their organization. So, recommend a timeline for implementation. One of the things that we think is important is that the group get moving quickly. Because one of the things that happens with a lot of political processes, right? Somebody gets an idea, you move forward. If you don't start moving down that road, pretty soon you're going to be derailed. You'll be off at the rest stop, right? And then you'll never be out. So that's a key part of it. Unfortunately, part of this, you know, is the process of getting a new building or a renovated building. Then that's going to take some time to do. So what we're proposing is that you form the organization right away, and then you consolidate in place. And what we mean by that is there's really no reason why you can't consolidate into one organization but still have two separate dispatch centers. It's not ideal. It's going to cost more money. But if everybody's on board for the short period of time, then you can start working on the HR issues, you can start working on the policy issues, you can start doing all of those things while you're working on the building. That'll get the process moving forward. And then start the CAD project right away. Dave said, we're going to make sure we tell them that we're not selling CAD systems, right? Because we've made a lot of noise about the CAD system structure. But CAD, a computer dispatch tool, is the primary tool that dispatchers and dispatch centers use these days. And so it's really critical that you get the right tool. I mean, you know, if you don't want to use a circular saw to cut down a tree, right? You don't want to use a chainsaw to, you know, cut off a 2x4. Well, maybe if you're rough cutting it, you can use a chainsaw, but you don't want to use it for finished carpentry, although I think I've seen some that's been done with a chainsaw. So the key part is you really want to get the CAD project moving right away. Both CAD systems are good CAD systems. You can make a decision as to which one you want to keep. There's really no reason why you can't have one CAD system and have remote terminals at either one or the other, the dispatch centers, and then start the building search right away. So get the process moving so that there's momentum behind it and people are, all of these other things that have to be done are not sidetracked by the search for a new facility. So what we're proposing is that you could get a binding memorandum of understanding or a letter of intent in 30 to 90 days. That's moving quickly. It probably won't be done in 30 days, but, you know, 90 days, I think, is probably reasonable, depending on, you know, what the meeting schedules are for all of the political entities that have to meet and pull that together. Get the mission, values, charter, and corporation documents. That would take about another 60 days or so to do. There's lots of sort of forms that can do, so it's not like you have to generate it from scratch. and then start off, and then once you get the sort of documentation pulled together as to what the organization is going to look like, then to verify with PERS that the organization will qualify to be a PERS-eligible entity. Now, obviously, when you're doing the incorporation documents, you're going to want to involve the PERS people to do that, because that is a key piece to making to being able to transfer the PERS liability from the individual entities into this new organization and then complete the incorporation. So 5 to 7 months is kind of what we're looking at for if you move forward quickly and you know, make this actually a project to do this. So in summary, there's few technical obstacles. They're all solvable. There really isn't anything that's going to cost a lot of money or you know, create a huge technical issue in terms of implementing consolidation. In fact, it'll actually reduce the number of technical issues that you have to deal with moving forward. Based on our research, we believe that the PERS issues can all be worked out. The true costs are identified, and the service level is higher, so the costs may be higher. So one of the issues that we get a lot when we do these studies is that people say, well, if we consolidate, it will cost less. Well, first question is less than what? Because a lot of times it's very difficult to really get a good handle on what the actual cost of dispatch is when you have a dispatch center that's embedded in an existing entity. Secondly, because we're adding supervision, we're adding some more technical support, the actual level of service to the organization, for example, keeping the maps up to date in the CAD system so you don't have to go and look on the big map on the wall, all of that support is going to cost more money. Now, the service level is higher, so the costs are going to be slightly higher. Service to the public would be a lot better. As you saw in the flow charts, you know, it can be quite convoluted today. The dispatchers today do an excellent job of managing that, but when things get busy, the more times you process a call around, I don't care how good you are, the chances of a call getting dropped or information getting dropped, two numbers being transposed, all that goes up. Service to the public safety responders would be better. Right now, you got a trooper out on the highway waiting for an ambulance to show up at an accident scene. It's quite a process to find out when that unit's actually going to be there. Or in the case, as Dave mentioned, domestic violence, you've got an issue potentially where you have EMS personnel going into a situation which may not be safe, and trying to keep that coordination together. So our recommendation is that consolidation process start within the next 30 days. Get committees formed, get people that are going to work on this together, start moving down that road, and that you could get to the point where you could have the articles of incorporation and be able to actually move forward and consolidate in place, start that process in the next 5 to 7 months. So at this point, that's sort of the completion of the presentation. As we said before, the handout that has been out is an excerpt of the report. The report goes into a lot more detail on how we got the growth numbers, on on other information in terms of how all that was developed. The report's 203 pages.
Yeah,
somewhere in that range. So obviously, it'll be something that you can read, you know, when you have insomnia some evening. But there's a lot of good background and support data in the report as to where we got the results.
Okay, we will note.
Mayor, if I could ask a question, yeah. Please, sir.
First of all, I want to kind of set this up so there's some order to it. We need to note for the record that Assemblymember Culver got here at 6:47. I'm going to suggest that we cycle through the cities and let each mayor field questions so that everybody gets a shot. Our soundboard man, Carl, has asked that when you want to speak, you raise your hand, because he doesn't recognize everybody's voice, and it's hard for him to know which of 20 mics he's got to open. So we'll see how it goes. We'll start down here with the City of Houston. Do you want to take questions from your council?
Yes. Is there any council members who would like to ask a question? Councilmember Wilson?
With the cost figures. I think what we've been presented is a good start, but it's not nailed down by any means. My main concern would be if we go with the proposal, how much is it going to cost? If it's going to cost us more, and we're told that it probably will cost more, will the improved service that we're supposed to be getting justify the increased cost? And I also would like to see some form of quantification of the increased service. Just saying that it's going to be a lot better is not good enough for me.
That reminds me of the one thing I was going to ask. We are going to have comments later. Let's try to stick to strictly questions right now. And is that it for Houston?
Any other council members? I have a lot of questions, but they're probably going to go into comments, so I'll wait.
Okay. Let's try to get our fact base under us first.
I do have one, though, just okay. For clarification. In this final draft on page 4, I would like to include the City of Houston as far as the decision criteria for calls in the Mat-Su Borough. We should have been included in this. We were not. Just a finding.
Okay. Palmer.
All right, very good. Council here. Members from Council members for the City of Palmer, do we have any questions? Councilmember Best.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. In the presentation, there was a bullet point that said workflow process inefficiencies and tool problems. And then a statement was made, two separate systems that don't talk to each other. A little bit later in the presentation, it was said that as we begin to go towards a consolidated system, you would get the two systems to talk to each other. Isn't it much more simpler to just get the two systems to talk to each other and we remain in the system that we have currently? Because when I call 911 in Palmer, I know that that person is familiar with my surrounding area. And so when you try to explain in your emergency situation what's going on, it's comforting to know that that person is familiar with your surroundings. So if somebody in Wasilla calls, their dispatcher is going to be dispatching out to somebody that is relatively familiar with their area. If we go to a consolidated system, you might not get that. And there is a little bit of kind of a feel-good about knowing that you're calling somebody that knows your area. So my question is, isn't it just simpler for us to get the two systems to work together?
Well, there's so there's two parts to that question. Number one is the implementation of a single CAD system would be the best solution, because anytime you have two different systems, computer systems, talking to each other, if Palmer decided to do an upgrade, for example, that might affect what Wasilla's CAD system, how that intercommunications would work, and vice versa. So it is much more complicated to try to get two disparate CAD systems to talk to each other. That said, there's really no reason why you couldn't put both dispatch centers on a single CAD system, even if they were to remain separate. So that should occur anyway. I would like to address the issue about familiarity with the area. We all like to think that the dispatcher that we call is familiar with our area. Unless in the job description, one of the job description requirements is that that person has to live with the city and has to have lived in this area for so many years, there's no guarantee that that person that answers that phone didn't just move into Mat-Su Borough from another area, let's say Southern California or the Seattle area, and as a dispatcher, and now sit down in that dispatch position and be answering the call. So, I mean, we feel that way, right? I mean, we all do, and it's a perfectly natural feeling because the tools, and part of it is the tools, right? If, you know, the I mean, I remember you not too long ago, you know, working on a project, and one of the concerns was it was a very rural island county that was going to consolidate into a bigger center. And they said, well, but what happens when the guy calls in the dispatch center and they say the accident or the fire is 2 miles south of Aunt Mabel's barn, and Aunt Mabel's barn burned down 3 years ago, right? And so the only people that know where Aunt Mabel's barn was are the people that lived on the island for all those years. Hey, I mean, I grew up in a rural area. I know all about that. The problem is that with CAD, you can put all that information into the CAD system. They have, you know, common name files. Somebody calls in, or a park, or a school, or any number of things. Intersection. I mean, I live at a place right near a place called Thrasher's Corner, right? Well, when I grew up, Thrasher's Corner was, you know, all woods and trees, and there was a little, it used to be a farm there owned by Thrasher's, and that's how it got Thrasher's Corner. Well, now it's a Fred Meyer and a Safeway and a Walgreens. There's no Thrasher's to be seen. It's still called Thrasher's Corner, but, you know, that information can be put into CAD and pop up and say somebody says it's at Thrasher's Corner, their actual address then pops up. And the same thing goes for the responders, right? Because the same issue, if you've got a fire responder that's lived, you know, in Palmer for, you know, 35 years, they know where that is. But what about the new guy that just came on board? Maybe he's 20 years old. He doesn't, you know where everything in town is. So it's a little bit, you have to be a little bit careful falling into the trap of knowing that, you know, thinking that everybody that answers the phone is familiar with the area. When you go to the Wasilla side, though, of course, they're dispatching for AST, and so that means that's the whole borough. So somebody that lives, let's say, just in Wasilla wouldn't necessarily be familiar with, you know, the entire borough. If they've lived here long enough, I'm sure they probably are, but they're not. So that's part of it. But even if the decision isn't made to consolidate, the very least you should put in one CAD system, because then you've got one set of upgrade costs, one set of maintenance costs, one set of mapping costs. The calls can transfer automatically. You don't have to. It could be entered in, at Palmer or at Wasilla. So, if it turns into a fire call, an aid call by an AST trooper, they can enter that in. That information can automatically then go back to Palmer. So there is some advantage there if you just do a single CAD system, regardless. Did I answer your question?
Long-windedly.
Okay.
All right, Councilmember DeBreeze.
Thank you, Your Honor. When you're talking about the additional funding, is that in addition to the $3.5 million that is currently being paid by all of the entities?
The actual budget numbers are in the report, and it's based on what level of staffing the group decides that they want to pay for. The additional funding required is on top of, the idea of, let's say, going to the higher tax, telephone tax, is to buy down the amount of cost that the individual entities have to pay out of their budget. In most cases, the cost will shift. So instead of paying Palmer PD, paying the dispatch costs now themselves, that money then would go to the consolidated center. Same thing for the borough dollars.
Councilor, please follow up.
Thank you. When you're talking about the consolidated center details, it says six staff positions. Is that per shift, or is that all day, 24 hours? Or
I can answer that. The six staffed positions would indicate that there are six desks, basically, that would be operated. We're recommending 24/7. There are three budget options in the final report, one that are divided up differently. But, so there would be staff to have somebody at each of those six locations 24/7 under the recommended option. That runs out to a total of about, I want to say 33 people altogether. If you look in your excerpt, I believe the budget options are in the excerpt, and it's option number 2 is the recommendation.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Any additional questions, City of Palmer?
Councilmember Best.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. You had mentioned in the report that one of the systems had difficulties with the borough's GIS maps. Which system is that?
Palmer.
Any other comments, questions, Palmer? All right. I have just, well, I'll leave the mayors at the end.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I guess I was just wondering, I mean, I guess I do have a little bit of concern just as it, with an accelerated timeline.
Excuse me. I was asked to find out, is this Assemblymember Arvin on the phone?
Good evening, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. We'll check you in on the record here at 7:05.
Thank you.
Sorry, Mayor.
All right, thank you. So I guess I'm wondering, I'm just trying to think, without the state troopers involved, I mean, it takes on a whole different look because they're more than half or close to half of the total budget. And then, like for Palmer, I'm trying to think what problems for the city of Palmer that we're trying to address. I mean, if it's not broke, we don't want to fix it. We don't want to hold anything back either. But just looking at it from our perspective, can you just express some of what you found with the city of Palmer? Because we do have a great dispatch group of people, and I'm really pleased with our dispatch center.
Well, I think both dispatch centers are, do a great job within the limits that they have. Like Dave said, you see them entering in data two or three different times into different systems. They've done a great job of doing that. I think the biggest issue is that with Palmer is that, Palmer's also dispatching fire for the rest of the borough. And so from that standpoint, there's more than just Palmer involved in that decision. So for the citizens that Palmer serves that are outside the city of Palmer, that's where there would be a definite benefit for the citizens. I also think that as Dave mentioned in terms of staffing, if Palmer were to have a major structure fire, or other event that resulted in additional resources being required, the dispatch center could fairly easily be overloaded trying to process that with just two staff members, working there, particularly at night. I mean, we've seen this, in multiple places. Most of the work we do is in rural areas, and we've seen this multiple times where smaller centers easily get overwhelmed, particularly with something like an apartment fire or, some other major event. Maybe a hostage event or something like that, where multiple resources are needed. Lots of phone 911 calls are coming in, and of course now they can't even transfer those calls to Wasilla because while Wasilla could take the information, they can't enter it into a CAD system then that would have that information show up. So they can't share those responsibilities. They can take information, but then they'd have to call right back to Palmer with that, with that information, which of course wouldn't really help the situation.
All right, thank you. Anyone else in Palmer City Council would like to ask any questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you. Wasilla, Mr. Mayor.
On behalf of Wasilla, any members of the council have questions this evening? Mr. Wall, Ms. Sullivan, Mr. Wall, do you have a question?
Yes. So the purpose of
So the purpose of establishing the nonprofit corporation, the concern there is, while we're saving some of the costs by the HR and everything else, the maintenance that the city would normally have, and moving it over to this new
corporation, there is a somewhat of a benefit in for the cities. We already have HR staff. We already have the directors in place. Those aren't going to go away. So how much of that are we really going to save for Palmer and for Wasilla by moving that over to that new corporation rather than just having the borough or one of the cities just handle everything? Does that make sense what I'm saying?
It does. It does.
So why not just have a city or the borough take over instead of making a whole new standalone organization?
Right.
And that is certainly an option that the group could consider. The reason for our recommendation for a standalone quasi-governmental corporation was so that you didn't have the so the mission it gets to be a mission point, right? So the mission of this organization then is to provide dispatch services to the citizens of Mat-Su Borough. That's their mission. It's not, and their budget and all the rest of the policies and all that don't get sort of caught up in another entity's internal, I don't want to say politics, because that's not really what I mean. I mean, obviously that goes on. But for example, if you're the city of Palmer Police Department, no matter how good of a job you try to do to be a regional player, and, it doesn't matter if it's Palmer, Wasilla, even the borough to some degree, doesn't matter how good of a job you try to be in that, you're still focused as the city of Palmer, right? I mean, your focus is still the city of Wasilla. And to some degree, your citizens and the taxpayers of your city might come back and say, well, why are you spending city tax dollars for providing services to, out to the unincorporated areas of the city? So when you get, so obviously you could take, In any organization, borough, either of the cities, you could take and form a separate department maybe and form that off and create an enterprise organization out of that department and say, we're going to identify all of the costs associated with this and everybody's going to pay into it, even ourselves, right? I mean, we're going to figure out what that apportionment is and do it that way. That certainly is a way to do it, and that is certainly how it's done in some places. So that is something that the group could figure out. If they wanted to do that instead of a separate standalone organization, they could do that. But of course, the other issue with that is all of the PERS liability then for those employees transfers to that organization then at that point. So if they decide later on that maybe that wasn't something they really wanted to do, now they've got to figure out what to do with the PERS liability. So that's a sort of another issue for doing the standalone.
I just want to expand a little bit on that. We only gave you what the recommendation is. The idea about having the borough do it or a city department, that kind of thing, covered in the report. It is something that we did study and ultimately made the decision to recommend a standalone. So it is.
Ms. Leonard Wasilla.
Thank you. My question is pretty quick here. With the thought that we've got a couple CAD systems here in place presently that we're utilizing, what would you foresee with those systems? Would they be able to be utilized to a new function then with the new, the new system in place that we're looking at? Or would those be scrapped and you would then rebuild a new CAD system then?
I think what probably would happen is you'd make a decision about which one of the two CAD systems to keep, and then you would just expand that CAD system going forward. On one hand you say, well, we've got money invested in this CAD system, we don't want to just throw it away. But on the other hand, those CAD systems have ongoing annual maintenance fees. And so to some degree, by cutting, by getting rid of one of them, then you reduce, your ongoing, sort of your ongoing cost. So that would be the approach, as well as improve the overall operation.
And have you had a chance to oversee the CAD systems that are in place presently? Is there one that's more up-to-date than the other, or Is there a recommendation to start over, or kind of what is the
do you want to talk about that,
thoughts,
Keith?
Here?
Yeah, thank you. Good question. Both of the CAT systems are Tier 1 CAT systems, so they're both capable of doing. But in either case, whichever CAT system you chose, you'd have to do some upgrades. So in either case, you'd have to add some modules. Now, there is, for the city of Wasilla, there is a CAT administrator in place who does a great job supporting the CAT system, which is not, unfortunately, the case of Palmer. There's no CAT administrator in place there. So to whatever extent that plays into your decision-making is up to the group, but both CATs are capable of doing all this work.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Woodward, Wasilla.
Some through Palmer, some through Wasilla, some through the borough for the service as a whole. And while we may not have captured all of the costs because some of them are a little buried, we actually do pay for all the costs. So I guess what I'm curious about is what things you think would we be saving on and what things are we not saving on? Are we not going to be saving on space, or is it the human resources component, or what are the different pieces that lead to the cost comparison issue?
Do you want to talk about that, Dave? Or?
Sure. So let me make sure I understood the question. The cost that we talked about is embedded costs, or costs that are part of the parent organization, or costs you're paying for now. Because those are difficult to quantify, it's not possible for us to say you're spending $3.5 million now, and under option two you'd spend $4.3 million, and the sum difference is what you're actually, that's the increase that you would be paying. It's somewhere north of that. You know, the $3.5 million is somewhere larger than that. That's and unfortunately that's about the best that I think anybody can do on that. I think the message that we heard loud and clear is, if you're looking to save money by consolidating, we would not recommend that would be the approach that you take, because if you take the same level of service that you have now and pull, even if everything else was exactly the same, the fact that you're putting it into another building where now those costs are becoming true, they're becoming visible, it's going to look like it costs more money, right, because those costs are now. The advantages here really are the improvement in customer service, the improvement in the and I hate to use this word, but the improvements in customer experience. If you are not having to transfer calls, if you're not having to tell your story a couple of times to get help, if where in the borough you're calling from doesn't matter in terms of who you talk to and how many times you have to tell the service. Those are the things that your folks told us were the biggest issues for them. And I think anybody who's ever had to call customer service for any, you know, credit card companies or whatever has got exactly those same issues. So that's sort of my kind of touchy-feely approach on that. There are definitely some savings that can be identified, especially in things like support. Right now, of that $3.5 million, there's a certain number, certain amount of that money that's being paid for support to the CAD systems. There's a certain amount that's being paid for telephone support, for building, and those kinds of things. So in those sort of hard costs where you're able to actually reduce systems, overall those costs would come down. And we have this conversation with, I think, probably every time we've ever done a consolidation study and made a recommendation, how much money are we going to save? And unfortunately, the answer is pretty much always that. You know, the reason to consolidate in probably 90% is better customer service and what can you save on support down the road. And let's face it, it's liability too. If you have systems in place where you are knowingly maintaining a complex relationship and making call processing more complex than it could be, you're probably going to generate more liability issues there.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that going forward, there'll be a reduction in capital costs that'll be required. So, for example, one of the things that's coming down the road, and it hasn't been identified as to who's actually going to pay for it yet, at least depending on who you talk to, are all the radio consoles are going to have to be replaced as part of an upgrade that's going on with the ALMR. That'll probably be in a year or two. Well, you know, the numbers that have been banding around are about $100,000 a console. So, you know, you've got 12 console positions, so you're going to have, you know, that much. I mean, basically you'll have half that capital cost. You know, CAD systems are going to need to be upgraded. You've got two CAD systems today that would have to be upgraded over time. You know, if you convert to a single CAD system, you'll have less of that. You know, moving forward into things like next generation 911 and all of those kinds of things, having a single unified entity that's handling that infrastructure, that interface, the policies, all those things will make all of that work better, you know, going forward. So it's not, you know, as we've tried to say before, a lot of people say, well, we want to consolidate to save money. Our response is, in most cases, unless you're a very, very small entity, and you're consolidating with a very, very big entity, you're probably not going to save money overall. But what you will do is you will make the dispatch process something that's identifiable, something that's responsible, and something that has you know, its own set of missions and clearly identified funding and objectives.
I would say also it sort of depends on the scope of what you're thinking about also. Will the cost be less for Palmer? Will it be less for Wasilla? Will it be less for the borough? Will it be less for AST? Will it be less region-wide? That's five different questions with five, you know, very different answers.
I guess that's kind of what I was trying to get to is the overall cost of all of the entities, and then what's the cost going forward? So instead of having two systems to maintain, two systems to upgrade, two sets of people to run the systems, two sets of people to maintain the technical aspects of the systems, would we save a little bit there, or at least end up somewhere about the same cost that we have now, but with just greatly better service? And I know it's impossible to quantify the liabilities, but that is a very real issue, and kind of into the comment section, but that's a concern that I had talking with a former dispatcher this evening, is a couple of incidents that she relayed where those could have been big, and I would imagine you probably are familiar with some cases that
absolutely, yeah.
Would be that. Thank you.
Okay, I guess that's forgot to raise my hand. Okay, we'll start with the assembly then, Assemblymember Keel.
First of all, thanks very much for your presentation. I think you have made a pretty good case for the need and the value of consolidation. On page 3 of your presentation in the executive summary, you state that the Department of Public Safety and the Alaska State Troopers' involvement is very important to the success of a consolidation effort. So if AST is opting out, or they've decided not to opt in, I'm not sure what. How does their decision to play or not impact the consolidation effort? And I guess how can it go forward without their involvement?
Well, if I guess the first part of that is if AST pulls out and develops their own dispatch center, then that's going to have a dramatic impact on dispatch operations in the borough, regardless of a consolidation. Certainly, if you look at the amount of budget that AST provides for Wasilla, having you know, that budget money go away from Wasilla paints an entirely different financial picture for them. In which case, then creates a whole different, you know, sort of set of dynamics there. The second part of that is, remember that call processing chart that we put up there.
is now all of a sudden, instead of having, you know, at least the calls going between Palmer and Wasilla, now they're growing somewhere, which you know, at this point we don't know where that might be if they were to do that. Now you have an entirely different, you have the vast majority of the land area of the borough being dispatched by a dispatch center that's, you know, potentially not in the borough. So I think at this point, if that were to happen, you know, it's too early to make any sort of guesses about what might, you know, how that might actually play out. It would certainly change the financial picture, and I think the group, I don't think that changes the, in fact, that might even make consolidation more critical, but exactly what that consolidation looks like might change. And so that's what the group would have to get together and talk about that and figure out how, you know, how they're going to do that organization. And to the councilman's question here, as we said in our report, we also looked at other options for consolidating. We recommended the standalone organization, but we did evaluate, you know, an organization that's run by another entity, and so that might be something you'd want to look at.
The other thing to consider when you ask your question is that not only would you lose the revenue, but you would also lose the expenses. And so there is some balance there of supporting AST with personnel, that you would reduce personnel costs if you did not have to support them. So although it's not a direct correlation, revenue to expense, but there would be some saving of expense, obviously.
I think along those same lines, I think the issue, one of the issues, and we've talked about it a little bit already, and that's what your minimum staffing level would be in a dispatch center. If it without AST, then there's a fairly large number of personnel that AST currently contracts for at Wasilla that might not be contracted for or not, might not be provided. So now if you were to look at how you would, you know, you would handle those calls, would you bring them all into a single center and still only have two people at night, you know, operating, or would you add a third person as a supervisor to that staff? Those are all kinds of decisions that the group would have to make, you know, however that group is sorted out, and you know, to deal with that, you know, those issues.
So just to follow up on that, in the process of this study, how much was AST involved, and did they show any indications about how they'd like to move forward?
Well, I don't really want to speak for AST. They were involved in the process. We interviewed with them. They came to the meetings. I think that that certainly, you know, there's a, I think there's a, one of the things we found with state entities, regardless of which state it is that the state police or the state troopers or whatever you want to call them in the particular state, they have a mission that a lot of times is different than the mission of local law enforcement. Usually it's a lot broader and includes lots of other things. One of the complexities here in Alaska, well, this isn't the only state that is this way, but this is one of them, is that in most of Alaska, local law enforcement in the unincorporated areas is provided by AST. That means that AST is essentially, you know, functioning as the county sheriff, right? I mean, that's how you sort of think of it. Well, that's a sort of a different role than in lots of other places. So the trick is, how do you balance that role, and how do you balance, you know, their statewide mission? I can't answer that. That's for AST and the Department of Public Safety to answer them themselves. But that's really the issue, and the issue that each of, you know, anybody that represents an unincorporated area or lives in an unincorporated area has to be concerned about how that mission, you know, gets handled.
Major Levesque is here and offered to speak to that. If you want to step up to the podium.
Good evening. My name is Matt Levesque. I'm Deputy Director of the State Troopers. I work in Anchorage. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this evening and appreciate the opportunity afforded by the borough to have been a participant in this process. In good faith, DPS participated. A number of the elected officials here who were at the very first kickoff meeting will remember that my opening comments on behalf of Commissioner Masters were that this was not the Department of Public Safety's preferred solution for a couple of the reasons that Mr. Blaschke mentioned, primarily relating to the fact that the department has statewide responsibilities and all of you have very defined geographic responsibilities. So our preferred solution would be to have a number of regional dispatch centers which would dispatch for Department of Public Safety and our state and other partners who rely on us in a number of locations. The purpose of our participation was because it would be rude and premature to have said, no, we don't want none of that. And so it was only until, 2 weeks ago when we got the draft of the final report that we were able to sit there and say, what's this mean for DPS? And ultimately, at this point, DPS doesn't see a way that participating in this center, proposed center, would make sense, although we recognize that it has tremendous advantages potentially for the cities involved in the borough, from at least an effectiveness perspective, if not from an efficiency perspective. The Department of Public Safety is reluctant to engage in establishing contractual relationships, which is essentially what would happen in the proposal, that would further bind us in ways that we're bound right now to the city of Wasilla and to the Kenai Peninsula Borough. Neither of those relationships, and I think the parties at least here from Wasilla can speak to the fact that it is challenging at a minimum. And so establishing a customer relationship with even more partners in another circumstance that wouldn't respect our statewide responsibilities just doesn't seem to make sense. Let me give you just the smallest example of how funding alone could skew the way the Department of Public Safety would have to interact. So as it's been proposed, there would be this board that would operate this center. It's a model used in many other places in the lower 48. It works well in many cases. I will say parenthetically that I challenged the team from ADCOM to find one example of a state agency which is involved in a regional dispatch center. They were not able to establish that there was one. Through my research, I know that there is a state that had done that to a certain degree and has stepped back because it didn't work. So let's talk about the funding piece. Right now, the 911 surcharge in the Mat-Su borough is fairly low, comparatively speaking. So it would make a lot of sense for there to be this board of which DPS would have a seat that would establish a budget, that would establish service level requirements. And so we would come out with, this is the budget, and it gets divided among the participants, however it gets divided. We would assume that a significant funder of that would be what? The 911 surcharge. The proposal is that the 911 surcharge be $2 a phone. So let's assume that that went forward. 3 years from now, there's a completely different borough assembly that says, that's crazy, it should be 75 cents. It used to be 75 cents. So now, arguably, we would be shifting the burden for running that center in which DPS was now tied to residents of the entire state through the general fund funding of Department of Public Safety. So I offer that as just one example of a way that people with the best of intentions to represent their constituents could do something that would ultimately harm the Department of Public Safety's statewide mission. And so at this point, we just don't see a way that we can integrate because there is no model that supports it, and it would seem to harm our ability to serve all of the citizens of the state. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I think that saved a lot of running around guessing what you guys were thinking. We do have a question here from Assemblymember Culligan.
So, saying you disengage, what is your time frame for that? So, if we decide to go to a different direction, when is AST planning to build out a regional center, and what's your time or solution for alternatives?
I know that we don't have a timeline. There is not a place, there is not a funding mechanism. And so you're saying, so this is crazy. You don't want this, but you don't have an alternative. And, yes, that's correct.
My point exactly. Thank you.
Thank you. Other assembly members?
Mr. Mayor.
Assembly Member Culligan.
So to the ADCOM team, there were some comments. I was trying to find it in the very beginning of unidentified costs that weren't possibly allocated out there. And questions I have, for instance, were there consideration of cost and time of the chief of police of Wasilla, Palmer, our EMS management to spend time managing or involved with dispatch? Was there consideration of the borough's GIS and other technical programming staff that support, for instance, Palmer's dispatch center for programming and otherwise beyond the generic providing the GIS data? Just trying to identify, I see you discussed certain positions that would be added for management to this separate entity, but we also have separate cost in each of our agencies for managing that, which isn't necessarily a core mission of police, fire, EMS versus call taking. I was wondering to what level or any are those unidentified costs, or what was that comment to?
Yes, to answer your question shortly, we did consider that, perhaps not to the detail that you've just described, but certainly the technical support and other support that a standalone entity would have to pay for. And essentially, that would be either through contracted services with the borough or other organizations who are providing that, by hiring their own folks to do that job. But those costs are real, and they are there today, and they need to be paid for as you're paying for them now.
We're paying for those costs individually, and we're talking about separating a separate dispatch center. Traditionally, a consolidated dispatch center, what is the relationship with the service provider, like the City of Palmer Police Department versus dispatch? Is there, running a dispatch center versus providing the police service or the ambulance service? How does that relationship change? What's the role and responsibility? Is there any direct correlation between call taking and the service? I can clarify.
I can maybe take a stab at that.
Okay. And I guess to clarify that, what I'm asking is there's a sense that you want to control the call or about the region when actually both dispatch centers are providing local support, but they're also providing borough-wide support. But is there any loss of control or service because dispatch is consolidated, call taking is separated out from the service providers? I guess I'm trying to drill down to.
Okay, I think I got it. Okay. The recommendation here is that there would be multiple levels of interaction depending on what level of the organization that you're talking about. So we talked about a board of directors, we talked about an executive director and technical systems and so forth. There also are, as part of our recommendation, operations boards that are advisory and policy agencies, which would be the board of directors. So the way we would see this, the way we see this is that the folks who are responsible for setting policy for the agencies would be representatives of each of the constituent agencies. So there would be policy authority people serving on the board of directors. They would then set the policy. We are going to do dispatch this way. We are going to take this approach to hiring. We're going to take this approach to insurance and so forth. That's all well and good, and it's important to do. There also are levels, however, that work directly with the operations people in both organizations. So very typically, for example, you would get all of your first line or middle management operational folks together, and they would advise their peers in the organization. This is all sounding really consultancy, so let me just simplify it. You'd get a group of your sergeants, your battalion chiefs, your lieutenants together. They would talk to the supervisors and the operations manager at the dispatch side and say, okay, we have this incident or this sort of situation coming up. How do you guys want to handle it? That's the question the dispatch folks would ask. They would then talk with all of the operations people. The operations people would determine either A, how they want to do it for their particular department, or B, maybe there's a need or a desire to have a standardized policy across the borough on how you handle a particular type of incident. That then would be incorporated in a procedure at the dispatch center, and the dispatch folks would carry out that procedure. So in a lot of ways, that, and the same thing on the technical side as well. So the technical folks at GIS at the county, for example, would get together with the technical folks at the dispatch center and talk about and figure out together what's the best way to reach our goal of pulling all the data layers in, making sure that the data maps properly and so forth. So we think it's very important at all levels of the operation that the customer's voice is heard at the dispatch center and the dispatch center's voice is heard at the field level so that they can meet and provide the service. At the end of the day, everybody wants to catch the bad guys and put the wet stuff on the hot stuff. So that's really the unifying mission there.
So the follow-up to that, just to clarify, is that the management, the police chiefs, and the EMS director are no longer managing and spending their time managing call-taking and dispatch. They're customers that have input through policy, but their day-to-day management responsibility, liability of their time is not managing that call-taking.
Correct. That would be the job of the executive director and the supervisors at the communications center.
Thank you.
Just a quick response on your question about the budget. In the full report, there is a detailed breakout of how the budgets were assigned and what all the costs were developed for all those different entities. So when the full report's released, you'll be able to see all the line items that went into making out.
And actually, for each of the three budget options right. That's summarized on your sheet, we've got full detail on each of those. So.
Right. Other assembly members? Assemblymember Woods.
Yeah. Thank you. Question occurred to me that is there any provision for catastrophe or in case of total power failures, earthquakes, et cetera, is the other emergency people, tower, and shortwave people, the ones that would take over it.
When any dispatch center operation needs to have effective and practice contingency planning, because it doesn't matter how well you plan, there's always a chance something's going to happen that wasn't anticipated. So in the case of a consolidated center, the center, as part of their policy, would have to develop a process and a procedure and the technology so that there could be a backup process backup plan that goes into place. So, one of the things that you do is you make your facility hard enough so most of the events that you might occur, an earthquake, things like that, would not take the center down. But if something did, that you would have a fallback plan where, maybe at certain fire stations, at emergency management, at other places, then you would have calls would get routed to, other things would happen like that. So that's part of the process that you would have to put in place, you know, when you develop a consolidated center. Just like you would today, even with your two existing centers, you know, each center themselves should have a contingency plan. So if for some reason that center is no longer functional, that call process can continue.
Is that it?
Thank you.
Anybody else on the assembly? Assembly Member Halter.
I'm over here. If the state troopers do go their separate way, we still have two separate CAD systems.
Well, our recommendation is that regardless of what happens with consolidation, that you do one CAD system.
The state troopers go their own direction, there'd be two separate CAD systems.
Is state getting their own CAD system, I think, is the question.
If they pull away from Wasilla and go their own route, regional centers like they're talking about, we'd still be in a situation where you have two systems.
It's probably too early to answer that question, but I'd probably buy a steak dinner that says the answer would be yes. We'd end up with two different systems, just because traditionally a state's mission is different than the local mission, so their CAD systems are a lot of times different.
Okay, Assembly Member Arvin. He's
no
online.
Comment, no questions.
Okay, no questions. Mayor Johnson had one question that came up late.
First of all, I just wanted to say how much I appreciated ADCOM and their professional look at dispatch. I think you guys did a very thorough job, and you're a pleasure to work with. And you've mentioned a couple of things that would be good to increase the efficiencies of the system, whether we do a full consolidated dispatch center or not. And one of those is a unified CAD system. Do you have any idea how much one a unified system in the scope of something that would service Palmer and Wasilla, the core area, might cost?
We do have some costing in the report. Mm-hmm. It's not exact, because you'd have to work with the eventual CAD vendor and negotiate the prices, but there's some rough models for either of the two CADs for what it would take to upgrade them to provide the service borough-wide.
And those are actually, the upgrades are actually, we approached both of the CAD vendors and put the same question to them. And although the numbers are not here, again, they're in that final report. So
do you remember any
we've
of those
got the, I was just going to ask Keith if he could look it up.
I will look it up.
We approached the two CAD systems are Interact and Tiburon is the name of the companies. And we did approach both on behalf of the study to say, you know, what would it cost to get the upgrade and do that. They both had... they both had answers, really good answers. He's looking it up here.
And while they're looking for that, the other thing that's really critical that we mentioned in the report is that you need to spend the money to develop an interface into the state systems, because one of the things that happens now is the state has Aspen and ARMS, two different record systems and database systems, and right now all of that work is being done manually. There's cut and paste. I mean, I guess one good thing with Windows is you can do cut and paste, right? But it's not really an efficient way to enter information in. With the automation that's available today, there's absolutely no reason, no technical reason anyway, why there shouldn't be an interface from the CAD system, so that when you run a license plate, when you do a traffic stop, for example, you run a license plate on the CAD system, that all those queries are done automatically, all the information goes to the state. If, you know, there's an event, or you run Wisconsin warrants, or they close out a case, whatever it is, all that information should automatically go into those systems. There's absolutely no reason why that can't be done. And that would reduce a tremendous workload, you know, in the dispatch centers that they're doing right now. As well as, you know, reduce the potential for error, because, I mean, when you type, right, it's pretty easy to type the same thing three times, right? Well, if you're lucky, you get them the same all three times, but, you know, might transpose a digit, you know, misspell something, you know, whatever. Did you find? And the
I
answer
did.
Is.
Thanks for stalling. We went to Interact, and we actually had them price out the interfaces, et cetera, and the other modules
that would be needed. And we got a rough order magnitude quote back from them, budgetary quote of $457,000. And then previous to our study, the folks at Wasilla had approached Tiburon and got a very similar number from them. That's in the body of the text here, so I'm looking for that. That was $579,000, as I recall. And then they had proposed a plan whereby the upgrade would be a capital cost of somewhere north of $125,000, and then the rest of the cost would be incorporated into the maintenance fees over the following 5 years. So it was, they were roughly about the same, $500,000 to upgrade either or.
So was that just an upgrade for the interface, or would that would actually be a unified system that could work
It would do both. It would include all the interfaces necessary, and it would be a unified system for the borough.
Okay, very good.
And, of course, until you actually sit down and negotiate a contract, your mileage may vary.
That's correct.
Okay, is that it from the assembly? Okay, before we go around for comments, we did agree to do audience participation because we're going to take a break as soon as comments are done. And first on our list is Mr. Butch Moore, followed by Jim Sykes, if we could queue up, and then Becca Lopez.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Butch Moore. Assembly members, I'm here to ask for your help. And I tried calling 911, but it didn't work, so maybe we should upgrade the system. I gave a packet out that I believe the clerk sent out to everybody. And the first, I think the first page is a letter, and this is regarding the gravel pit, Pit 6, to expand the rail down to Point McKenzie off the end of Sioux City Parkway. QAP is a current contractor working on Segment 3. My property is adjacent to the gravel pit. And back in 2011, November, the Mat-Su Borough, the letter is attached on the front, and I'll read it for those of you who don't have it. The Land Resource Management Division requests the railroad build slash upgrade to borough standards 4,878 feet of the Susitna Parkway Road in exchange for the administrative fee for use of borough-owned gravel from the Susitna Parkway pit, map attached. So they're going to upgrade the road, the railroad is, QAP, in exchange for the borough's gravel because it's a borough asset and we can't give it away. It has to go up for market value. So through the process, one of the things that we came up with, also in the, I think in the back page of your packet, was adjacent on the northern boundary of the pit, we were to put a berm 15 feet high, 60 feet wide, and a 90-foot vegetated buffer to buffer my property from the gravel pit. And everything went through, and I got a couple phone calls, and they didn't really want to build that berm. It's 3,000 feet long. The one thing we didn't take into consideration is the topography. There's a lot of topography, so to build a berm on a 45-degree slope up a 90-foot hill, it's going to be huge. It's not going to work. So I took my contractor out there, and I said, you know, QAP doesn't want to build it. Borough doesn't want to build it. But yet the ordinance says they need to build it. And I said, why don't they want to build it? I mean, let's look at it. He says, man, this is a mess. It's probably going to cost $400,000 or $500,000. And I said, you're right. So this last March, I came before the assembly and asked that you would direct the manager to work with me to reach a resolve so that we could resolve this issue. And what we've resolved is I have agreed to reduce the size of the berm from 3,000 feet down to 200 feet. That's going to save the borough a lot of money, right? Well, QAP got the contract. They bid it to include the berm. Somehow, the road improvement got left out. They're not improving the road. So part of the help I'm asking for here today.
Is that the 3 minutes? Yeah, I forgot to tell you, the clerk's listening over there.
Okay.
So wrap it up.
I'll wrap up. So part of the help I'm asking for today, I've worked through this with the manager. I think we have a resolve to it. Right now, we're in violation of borough code because we're given the railroad gravel. QAP is going to pull out of there. We started this in March, April, May, June, July, August, September. They're almost done. They're not building the road. They're not building the berm. And they haven't met the ordinance. So we're trying to change the ordinance, but this is going to go another month or two to go through the process. And the manager has worked on getting some good verbiage in that. There is a contract in existence that staff has with QAP to build the shorter, smaller berm and improve the road in lieu of building the longer berm. So what I'm asking the assembly tonight is, can the assembly direct the manager, because this would be a decision under $100,000, doesn't have to go to the assembly, doesn't have to go back to an ordinance, can the assembly direct the manager to execute the contract to build the shorter berm and improve the road? That way, the borough is getting paid for the gravel.
We got the point. We'll work with the manager, try to get it worked out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate speaking tonight because I wanted to bring everybody up to date. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Sykes, followed by Ms. Lopez.
I can hold the mic. Good evening, distinguished mayors, members of the assembly, members of the city councils. My name is Jim Sykes. I live in a straw bale house on Lazy Mountain, and I came here tonight to talk about the ferry. I've tracked the course of the ferry over the past year, and it seems like we've switched directions 180 degrees, and sometimes there's a good reason to do that. I'm really open to new ideas, and I like the idea of putting the Susitna ferry into service someday. But as I've watched the process, what I don't see is a clear destination. Whenever a boat sets sail, they generally chart a course with a destination in mind, and I'm not real clear what the destination is here. Is the destination to keep the ferry and actually put it into service? Because you know that ferries are going to be subsidized no matter, like other transportation forms are, and actually make sure that that's the bridge to the bridge, the Kinnikahn Bridge. Is the destination just to get rid of what many perceive as a liability, to just get the ferry out of here and keep as much money, taxpayer money, from being drained away by the ongoing saga? Is the destination to store it here and try and reduce those costs? And we've heard a variety of opinions about whether or not that's a good idea. But what I really see missing here is transparency and a very thorough risk-benefit analysis. We need to know what the real benefits are for any of these decisions or a variety of others that you may wish to consider, a range of what the real benefits are and the costs associated with them. We need to know what the range of downsides are, whether they are minor downsides or real disastrous major downsides. And I don't see that lined up for the list of options that have been considered over the past year. So I guess what I'm asking you to do is let's end the fairy tale and get real. Get real numbers, get real ranges, and have an across-the-board comparison that is somewhat more in-depth than what we've been getting. Maybe don't have to go quite as in-depth as the previous presentation, but I think that it deserves that kind of study and that kind of public understanding of what the options are. Otherwise, it just looks like another course correction that doesn't have a destination in mind. So whatever you choose to do, I hope that you very carefully consider it and make sure that it is accountable to the taxpayers and not just another add-on project that has come up, which looks to have come up rather quickly, without a lot of forethought. And so that's why I ask you to take a deep breath and think it over very carefully before you decide. And that's what I'd like to see. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Lopez? I think the bell rang just after you finished.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Lopez. I'm going to give you my quick bio so you understand where I'm coming from. I was a 911 dispatcher for almost 12 years. I started in the city of Bethel for about almost 4 years, and then I came to Wasilla, and I was a dispatcher there for almost 8 years. So in city of Bethel, I was trained by a really great trainer who came from a really large center in Oregon. So I was trained as a large center person in a very small town and manpower of one. And we did everything, fire, EMS, and troopers, and the police. Troopers, of course, were kind of unofficial because it was after hours, holidays, weekends, anytime the clerk wanted to take a break. But so we had it more than they did. And then I come to the city of Wasilla, where we just did police and troopers and not fire and EMS. And it makes a very big impact on a person's life, and it makes a very big impact on the dispatcher's capabilities of being able to do their job the most efficiently. Every delay you have in getting that caller on the line can cost them their life. And so when you're talking about money and you're talking about quantifying, you can't, because you can't quantify those lives I saved. You can't quantify those officers who weren't shot because I got the information they needed. But I will tell you, I almost lost an officer one night, and I'll never forget this night. And troopers, I hope you're listening, because it was your guy. 911 call comes in to Palmer PD. They did a fantastic job. They got their information. They transfer the call over. It was a 911 misdial. Person's talking to me on the phone, answering all my questions, no hesitation. I can hear other people in the background. They sound like they're having a good time. Okay, maybe he really did mean to call a department store instead of 911, which sounds ridiculous, but people call for what time of the day it is. So I'm thinking, okay, it all kind of sounds okay. Then he says, I know it's your policy to send an officer for every 911 call, so that's okay. I never said that. I never tell off anybody that, because it puts your officer's life in danger. I'm telling you that today because I thought maybe Palmer had said it with the new dispatcher or something that didn't understand that. Well, when I got, my officers got on scene, that guy was laying in wait for them. Women came screaming out of that house, he's got a gun. And my officer almost was shot as he entered that home. My officer called me, who I had a very good rapport with, and he was very upset and felt that I let him down and I put his life in danger. Dispatcher has two priorities. One is officer safety, and two is everybody else's safety. I'm sorry, I'm going to go over, please. So I played back that call. What did I do wrong? That call was a perfect call. I didn't do anything wrong. But I heard on the playback, when I could hear Palmer's call and mine together, Palmer, he said the same thing to Palmer Dispatch. Had I heard that right off the bat with no other dispatcher involved, I would have told my officer something's wrong. Something is off. And they would have been prepared. There's another one I really quickly am going to tell you because I know I'm over my time limit. But you can go back and look this up in the newspaper. Several years ago, there was a woman attacked with a machete. She attributes her life today to that 911 dispatcher who stayed on the phone with her. It's a very hard call when you have to decide, do I keep the person on the phone with law enforcement to get all the details I know my troopers, my officers need, or do I transfer them back to Palmer for life safety, where they can give the medical advice to keep that person alive while the troopers are en route? Because your ambulances cannot go on scene until an officer gets there, because that's the borough's policy. So you have to have both dispatchers working together. It's really hard when you have to be on the phone and you have to be on the radio, but oh my goodness, I have another partner all the way across the town, or in another town actually, all the way across the borough, I have to talk to. So now I have to have another dispatcher call that one to get me the information I need, because I can only have two ears. So please, don't give up, because the troopers are saying right now they don't want to come on board.
Thank you. Okay. We'll start with Wasilla. Comments?
Thank you, Mayor DeVilbiss. I'm going to make it extremely brief. I'd like to thank ADCOM so far to date for all the hard work you did in putting this report together. I'm sure there's more information we're going to be needing, so stand by. I was surprised by Ms. Lopez being here. She used to be a dispatcher for the city of Wasilla until she moved on to a much better paying job. But she's absolutely right. She had extremely salient points. This isn't about, you know, who's making a buck over here or making a buck there or saving a buck here or saving a buck there, or what Major Levesque and the troopers want to do necessarily. This is about regional public safety and the public safety in our individual cities. And, we're growing and growing quick. Another decade will be twice the population, and I'll be out of office. But, you know, if we don't get our act together now, we're going to be extremely behind the power curve trying to consolidate things in so we can actually produce a decent public service. Thank you.
Did your council members want to?
Oh, yeah. Mr. Wall, let's start with you.
Nothing.
Ms. Sullivan-Leonard.
Thanks. I just want to say thank you to the gentleman here presenting for ADCOM. I think you've done a really great job. And if you wouldn't mind, if the rest of the elected officials could have your report maybe on CD to all of us, the longer version, so we can look at it in more detail, that would be very much appreciated. But also, life and safety, it's a big deal. It's a big deal in each area of the Mat-Su borough, and I think consolidating is something we've been looking at for a long time, and I think it's time for us to move forward on it. Thank you, everybody.
Mr. Woodworth. Thank you. Mayor DeVilbiss, your show.
Okay. Palmer, Mayor Johnson.
Councilmember comments. Councilmember Irby.
No comment,
Your Honor. All right. Thank you. Councilmember Combs.
I think that we've been given a great deal to consider, and I appreciate the information. Some of it's almost overwhelming. I have had the experience over the last 28 years of having absolutely terrific service from our public safety officials. Of course, the fact that I live about half a block from here probably has a great deal to do with that. But I also have family that have served in these areas. I currently have a brother that's a paramedic in the borough, and I've heard of some of these stories. I agree with Mayor Ruprecht. Regional public safety is something that it's very easy for me to sit comfortably half a block from here and know that I can pick up the phone, and frankly, I do believe the dispatchers know my house. But we do need to take into consideration, there's so much to consider. I sincerely believe that everyone at this table is interested in regional public safety. We do have to balance today's concerns regarding the bottom line. That's just a fact of public service life. But we have to remember that we're putting lives first. And again, I thank you for your time and the information.
All right. Thank you, Councilmember Combs. Councilmember DeVries. Councilmember Best.
The information that we did get is very informative. I am very curious to see the long version of it, though, because I think this is a very difficult question to ask, and I would like to have had the report before we came here tonight, because then we might have been able to give a little more detailed questions and kind of drill down through things. So I look forward to another meeting discussing this.
I guess I would like to just echo what a number of our council, my council member said, but public safety, of course, health and welfare is why we have government, and we certainly want to do the very best that we can to make sure that we ensure that. So I want to thank the borough for funding this study. I know there's going to be a lot of things that are that we can evaluate. Our dispatch system, all of our different dispatch issues, whether they're all consolidated or not, we're going to find a lot in this study. So I know that the borough had that done, and so thank you to the borough as well as Assemblymember Culligan for bringing this issue to light, because I definitely think that there's issues to look at and to improve on, and we look forward to working on that and making it better for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Houston.
Councilmember Jorgensen? Councilmember Hartley? Councilmember Wilson? Okay. Deputy Mayor? She's right here. She's next.
I just want to thank you, gentlemen, for presenting the information. Everybody here is very informative. I agree with my fellow Councilmember Wilson and some of the people that have echoed the sentiment of more solid numbers when it comes to how much this is going to cost. Yes, this is a very human thing. It's a life-saving issue. I think consolidation with or without the state troopers should go forward. I'll do a comparison between, from my own experience, aircraft carriers, the Enterprise versus the Nimitz. The Enterprise had 8 reactors, the Nimitz had 2. When you consolidate that much reactor space and things like that, it's a more efficient, more war-fighting ship. The same thing with the EMS system. I think there's a giant crack in it right now, and you mentioned liability multiple times with that, because there's a giant crack between having to communicate back and forth and something getting dropped, it becomes a liability. Consolidating would eliminate that. I mean, a single system overall, and I would encourage the troopers to stay on board with this program. I don't think we're going to price gouge them, or, like he said, the concern for the future and something like that, what happens when the assembly changes and everything like that, or the whole community changes and everybody goes, oh, we don't want to spend that much money. Well, they can always opt out and tip out and say, hey, you know, if you're going to change this back to 75 and you're going to put the burden on the Department of Public Safety, we're going to have to leave. And then they're going to have to consider that. But that's a future consideration. For them, they're going to have to stand their own stuff up from ground zero, you know, from absolutely nothing to something like that. I think it would be more cost-effective for them to just stay with the program. Hopefully that happens. Also, in your plan, what about future consideration for or that you need to be thought about is for future expansion. As the borough grows into larger and larger and more services are needed, the building that they use, the number of personnel, et cetera, the system itself, I agree wholeheartedly with one system, one CAD system, and you choose it, what everybody agrees on, and goes. Dispatch personnel. I personally think it should not be whatever dispatch, if it comes to a consolidation, everybody agrees on that, it shouldn't be given to a particular city. No offense, folks. Not a particular city. It should be independent by itself, and that the personnel who are currently working in both dispatch centers should have first priority as that job, period. Because I consider that unfair, that it would, because we make this new consolidated center, they go out and either get a whole bunch of new people or one city is favored versus the other, anything like that. I'm just thinking of the people who are actually doing the jobs. What else? And that's it for me on this subject. The only thing I want to give to the assembly, because I know we're probably going to be leaving this on the Susitna, is you might want to consider, as I already spoke with Warren about that, is consider contacting the Navy again and offering it up for a buck and see if they could use it for whatever need they be, or even the Coast Guard. Just a consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor. Councilmember Barney?
I don't know how you follow that, so if I have no comment.
That's a true statement. I don't have a lot to say myself. Thank you so much for covering all that. Basically, the bottom line is, as said several times, service for public or the people to make it better. So, yeah, we do need to really look at this as a group, and the state needs to also be involved. That's just my opinion. And I think the people need to be part of this, because the bottom line is, as it rolls down the hill and as the money goes up, they're going to be paying. So they need to be part of this process. And maybe they are the ones that should make the decision as to whether or not it's fully funded. Maybe the state needs to run it. Well, you know, we don't know what the full answer is. We'll see.
Okay. I'm going to ask the assembly if you volunteer if you want to make a comment. Assemblymember Culligan.
So, number one, I really appreciate ADCOM, your work, and thoroughness to this part. Obviously, we as a body have brought up more questions, drilling down, and this is a subject all of us sitting around the table worthy of an engaging discussion. We are not going to agree on all of this, but we have a responsibility around this table as leaders to address this problem. And I think this is deserving of a future workshop after maybe us getting some more questions and having a little bit more further work done to have a more engaging discussion in a workshop fashion. The other comment about dispatchers, I think they're kind of like, for me, senior programmers. They're not sitting around the bench ready to be dusted off. They're a highly desirable commodity and well-trained, and the good ones are. So I don't think we have an issue of that. You know, we have good skilled trade folks that have experience, but there's no consideration in my mind that, you know, they decide to quit or something, we're going to easily replace them. We are competing for anchorage that maybe pays more, et cetera, over time, but the reality, just get that out of your mind. And there are other options that haven't been discussed here. And it was interesting. I really appreciate Major Levesque's input, and he brought up the question of where around the nation does a community share, statewide sheriff or trooper entities with local service. And I think he's probably right, but I know there are instances where they work in the same center. They're not the same, but they share some of the same facilities and coordinate regionally. And all of us would love to be in control of all of this, like, but every one of us sitting around the table doesn't have the money in our own budget to run all of this. So we need to take a hard look at this and our responsibilities. This is a shared liability for every one of us. And I can think of one instance 10 years ago where the former Commissioner of Public Safety girlfriend went to Eagle River and shot him and his wife, and they spent 45 minutes looking for his house because they couldn't find the address because of a technical data error ingested in that CAD system. We are not here because we made a mistake. We're here because things have changed. We don't live in Mayberry anymore. We're a growing community, and technology has changed, and complexities have changed. We have people with mobile phones that can call in. We as a community are dealing with how to address towers and other stuff as we grow up that are essential services to us to find. We have a responsibility to find and provide service to those people. So at the end of the day, I think collectively, if we can commit ourselves to submitting some questions, I think there's some future numbers we need to refine, but committing ourselves to having an engaging conversation, and yeah, we may be sitting back with our arms crossed and the like, but we have a responsibility to provide the best service with what's available today, and I think we can do that at the same dollar and maybe less, and there's other alternatives. With the state and other folks, and the municipality of Anchorage is now going through the same consolidation. They're looking at consolidating police and fire and ambulance within their own entity. And it may be that we can't, a regional dispatch center isn't in Mat-Su, but we need to have this engaging conversation and address our own needs, and we need to work with the troopers and support their vision and their needs as well. And with that, I just thank you very much.
Thank you. Assemblymember Keough.
There's been, as we discussed and heard the presentation about a consolidated dispatch center, there's been several comments regarding change and growth, and we certainly are, and so I just would like to mention this, as we not only consider this issue but several others, there's a very recent study here about the fastest growing counties in the country of 750 counties in the United States. Based on population growth, employment growth, and income growth between 2007 and 2011, we're the 13th fastest growing county or borough of these 750 counties. So, I mean, I'm stating the obvious, but we are growing, and here's more evidence that we have it based on population, income, and employment.
Thank you. Assemblymember Culver. Pull your mic into you. Yeah.
No. Okay. My first response is probably similar to many of you here, and like the troopers, well, costs more, it's complicated. And then the powerful testimony, Ms. Lopez. I mean, she identified what the job is. The job is to save lives, assist public, coordinate the emergency services. I think what you did was point out how dysfunctional our system is, that we have to pass phone calls on, we're not sharing information. So we all just can't go in our own corner and do our own thing. If we're going to deliver a public service and save lives and plan for the future and be the largest metropolitan area in Alaska, we got to start acting like it. So we've got a lot more work to do, and we're going to have to engage the state. We all need to be. We need one center. Our law enforcement is the troopers, except for in the city of Wasilla and Palmer. And we have to all cooperate because there's a lot of stuff going on in this community. And the more we just kind of ignore it and we don't share information, we end up, the problems fester. And you can go on streets, side roads, you know, people shooting weapons at stuff like street lights. And, you know, you'll see it in the larger cities, the graffiti and things. If you don't keep a handle on the little things, it become big things. And so I think what this, and I don't have the full report, you know, so I don't know how much background data we did, but we need interviews with those dispatchers. We need the people in the trenches to tell us what the problems are and kind of start there to solve the problem. I think the costs are an issue, but I think we probably do need to start, how are we going to consolidate some of these emergency service calls on a more regional basis, identify those bottlenecks, collect the data. What are the stumbling blocks to delivery of the service, and that the service has to come first, not the dollars. And I think that's where all of us as policy setters, that's the first thing I looked at was the cost. Oh, this is going to cost more. So I already came into this thinking that this wasn't such a wonderful thing, but Ms. Lopez changed my mind. And so I think we know more of that anecdotal evidence and data on what the service delivery, what are the dysfunctions in our service delivery, so we can address it with good policy and get everybody really at the table. We're kind of talking around the edges, but we need to have the stakeholders in, and I would think our public would be best served if we had all agencies and all responders consolidated into one service. And so I think we need to go back and do that research if we don't have it already. Did we collect that data?
Yes, it's in the report.
Okay, well, if you could prepare a synopsis of what the feedback from those folks is for us, as well in your executive summary, it'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Assemblymember Solomon, welcome.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, this is a little too personal probably for the moment, but there's a song that states, in a New York minute, everything can change. One moment, my first wife was alive. The next moment, she was gone. One moment, I was driving my car and could walk, and the next moment, I could not. Now, she passed, I lived. But the point is time. And what we're addressing here is the time for the response to get to the people. And we've heard dollars, dollars, dollars. That's a very important thought. No one thought this would be easy. No one thought this would be cheap. But here's the point that I'm trying to make. When it comes to time, what is a life worth to you? $1 million? You say, well, that's too much. I say, well, what if it's your life? Or what if it's your wife? Or what if it's your child? changes the entire complexion. So it isn't the two things I heard tonight that imposed itself upon me more than any other was the time for response and the purpose that has been echoed across the room, customer service, and the other was the customer experience. Well, my experiences have been very, very well with the system that we have, but I'm not saying that it couldn't be better, and I am in accord with working towards a consolidation. But again, not going to be easy, not going to be cheap, but the dollars are incidental in my life and in my mind. So thank you for the opportunity to express that rather personal moment with you.
Thank you. I guess that's everybody. Assemblymember Arvin? No comment, I guess. Well, thanks. Everybody, this is a lot of information. I see another committee coming. Probably us mayors will bring something together to in the way of a recommendation. And it's a little disconcerting that we may not have the state troopers with us, but we'll work it out. Thanks, everybody. We'll take a 10-minute break and then come back on the rest of our agenda, cities can leave if they want. Okay, we have a quorum. At least near the table, and we moving into the assembly business. And first up is the ferry update and discussion. And I imagine the manager would like to kick that off. Assemblymember Arvin, are you still on the line? Assemblymember Arvin? Don't hear Assemblymember Arvin, but everybody else is here. So go ahead, Mr. Manager.
Good evening. Just for question and answer, we have Dave Cruz here, who we have been working very diligently last 10 days on the proposal. We also have Mark Von Dagen, a port director, and then we have J.P. Storm. I don't know if you know J.P. J.P. has been our ship's captain and ship's manager and from Wasilla, and he's been working real hard with us, and we're fortunate to have him. So, J.P., this is J.P. right here next to Mark. So what we have done is, with my direction, we were given the direction on bringing the Matanuska Susitna to Port McKenzie. And so we've been working on that and looking at the options, tightening down the costs, and going through it, we had a separate option. When we put the original proposal was to bring the ferry and put it on the port, and that would take up about a third of the space on the port. And we estimate this is a 3 to 5 year project. And we thought it would be better if there was another option besides taking up that port space that we've already invested in. So we came back and worked with Cruz on what if we put it on the north side of the port and got cost figures for that. It is a little more. It will have an advantage on infrastructure that will lead to the future, and but it will preserve all the port. In addition to doing this and moving us forward, I have issued two POs to Cruz. One is for them to do this analysis work for us, and the second is to have a certified inspector kind of go through down to Ketchikan and prepare the boat to bring it up here. One is a $40,000 purchase order and one is a $50,000 purchase order. The cost to bring it up and put it beside is 1.8. Now, included in that number is we have to build it higher, have to protect it. But one of the things that we want to make sure of is when we bring it up and we're going to put it back in service, we winterize that or put it to bed properly so in 3 to 5 years we are ready, it's ready to go. I mean, one of the comments that have been made, if you bring it up here, It's just going to sit up here and rust. You'll never put it back in service. And we have a plan that if it's brought up here and put on, it will be put back in service. There will also be maintenance because there's over 100 valves that need to be turned on a quarterly basis or a monthly basis, and we will be getting prices with that. The last thing I want to say specifically about that is the 1.8 figure there, that is Cruz's proposal, but also with that it gives us an opportunity to go out and bid out and get different quotes, local companies to kind of do that work, to give us an opportunity to drive down that cost. Now, with all this, to do work on the north of the port or at the port, we need to get a permit from the Corps. Right now, I'm here to tell you that it's we have a slim to zero chance of that happening by October, and it has not been because of the effort of Cruz or your port director or your staff. But we have we're out of compliance on Port McKenzie Road, and it's going to take us 6 to 9 months to conclude. And we think because we're out of compliance on that, Mark is here to kind of give you the details on that, because I know you're going to want to know that. We think the Corps is going to be very hesitant to give us a permit to do so because we have that outstanding out of compliance on Port McKenzie Road. So tonight, we have the plan to go forward. If we move forward with that, we think it's probably going to be a next spring trip up to put it there. But we are also looking at some different options. One is to reduce the cost at Ward Cove. When our costs at Ward Cove are last year, we have been prepared to have that boat ready for anybody who wants to come and see it, go on a demonstration, make sure it's in good working order so we could actually bring buyers up to sell. We have some ways to reduce those. In addition, we looked at different ports. We looked at Seldovia, Port Graham, Seward, and Homer. Right now, it only looks like Seward is our option. That would be a less expensive option, too, to get us through the winter. Or, because really the end game is, from my direction of the assembly, is to preserve it, get the port landings built, and then find a partner to actually operate the ferry as opposed to ourselves. We may be able to do all that at a cheaper cost than actually bringing up and dry docking. So with that, first, because I know you're going to ask, Mark, can you please give us what we are out of compliance are at the Port McKenzie Road?
You might as well invite your team up to the table.
Yeah, there's a mic over there, and there's a mic over there.
Sure, yes. Go ahead and sit down. There's open mics there at the table.
Mr. Mayor, Assembly members, I'm Mark Van Dongen, Port Director. About 6 months ago, we received a letter from the Corps, a notice of violation pertaining to two projects that we have completed, the Point McKenzie Road upgrade and paving project, which was done in 2008, and then the hill reduction project that we completed last year, the last hill going down to the docks. Part of the requirement for the permit that we had was mitigation. We were required to put a deed restriction on some wetlands in the Port District in return for filling in wetlands that we filled along the road and on the hill project. And the borough failed to complete the deed restriction. I thought that had been handled years ago, to be honest, and I thought it was a simple thing. It turns out it's not. We have had a series of meetings with the Corps this year. Initially, they wanted us to fall under the new rules, which would require us to pay for the mitigation, which would be upwards of $750,000. And I was able to convince them that because they approved the permits for those two projects under the old rules, that we should still fall under the old rules, and all we need to do is a deed restriction, and they agreed with that. And so our land department is working on that. They got a couple of samples from the Corps of how to do it, but it's apparently a more timely process than I thought. At some point here in the next couple of months, I think they'll be bringing the action to the Assembly for approval to approve that deed restriction, and that'll lift the notice of violation that we have. So we have another permit that I submitted a while back for our deep draft dock expansion, and that got placed on hold when they told us of the permit violation, so they're not processing that. I'm not in a rush to get it. It's a permit that I want to obtain. And we were hoping that our contractor, Cruz Construction, representing the borough, might be able to get the permit rather than us trying to get it with this notice of violation. But we're still the benefit of the permit, and even though Cruz would be applying for it, our manager would have to sign it, and therefore the Corps will not approve the permit, is what they told us, until we satisfy that mitigation requirement. So that's the reason for the violation.
Mr. Manager.
Thank you, Mark. You know, one of the things that we've done, and I believe we have our finance director on the line. Tammy, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Okay. We have worked on reducing the cost of insurance. Also, too, there is a reduction in our cost to protect the boat, operate the boat, that we can greatly reduce that if we're going into a different mode. So JP and provided some information. Could you kind of, you know, the point at Ward Cove, how that price reduction is? And I know Dave and his team have worked on the options at Seward also to a price reduction. The difference is between Ward Cove down in Ketchikan, Seward is up in our neck of the woods, and there may be an advantage to consider that as well. But JP, can you talk about the cost savings, and then Dave follow up with Seward?
Can you hear me? Am I doing this right? Haven't done it before. Okay, well, currently you're paying 80 cents a foot for the vessel. That's 300 feet because of your headlines and stern lines. I know your insurance, I think you've had that reduced to about $40,000 a quarter, $160,000 a year. Right now you've got 24-hour-a-day maintenance and security on there. What I'm looking at is 2 hours a day, one man, exactly the supervisor I have on there right now. And that fluctuates. I mean, if it's bad weather, he's got, you know, you kind of have to look after the boat. There's no capstans on the vessel. It's all hand tight. When we have to tighten lines, we have to get a come along and do it by hand. So you do need somebody down there. I talked to Spokley's, the owners of the dock. They agreed to drop the cost per foot to 50 cents a foot, which is $4,500 a month. With having a man on there 2 hours a day, and you're down there at 50 cents a foot. The insurance, I put a theoretical price on it at $10 million for the vessel, and talked to an insurance broker in Seattle, a guy that does state ferries there, and he estimates no higher than $75,000 a year for what they call port risk. That includes the ability to run the engines at the dock and also take the vessel from the dock a stated number of miles offshore should you want to run it. That's not a bad deal there. Basically, we'd be draining all the things like fresh water, turning off the hot water heaters, turning off the water fountains, turning all that stuff, and keeping heat on in the engine room and the water jet rooms. I think the electric will be about $2,000 a month. You're running about $4,500 average right now. But there are quite a few heaters on last winter, not now. So it's a significant cost reduction, and you're looking at right around $210,000 a year for keeping it in Ward Cove. The same engineer I have on there now would be starting the engines every month like he does now. And basically, you're not going to have to winterize the engines. You don't have to do that. You just keep doing what you're doing. The only down part is if you have somebody that wants to come and go for a boat ride, we'll have to get a crew down there. And I mean, I'm generally around, so it's not impossible. But it's a good, they call it a wet long-term layup is the phrase that's used.
Okay. Members of the assembly, our company has looked at this thing upside down, forward, backward, every way we can to reduce cost. And ultimately, I feel the goal here, I feel the vessel needs to operate in Cook Inlet. I don't feel the borough needs to be in the boat business operating it. With that in mind, I think it's absolutely critical. You have our Knick Arm Crossing is in jeopardy of failing due to the fact it's a $1 billion price tag with a foreign nation financing it. And the opportunities available now, because you own that vessel, is this becomes a state issue. But for this to work, you can't talk about having a boat around that we got a boat down in Ketchikan. People have to be able to see, feel, and touch that boat. So my recommendation is to bring the vessel up, let Anchorage see this, let the residents of the valley see it. You have a dock that you can tie it to, as pointed out today by our marine manager, for 8 months of the year. So tie it to your own dock. That other period during the winter that there may be ice present and we're not ready to handle that, then our option that we're looking at today is taking to Seward. Seward has a private dock there that was at the old sawmill on Nash Road that Chugach Alaska Corporation has. It's large enough to bring a ship in against. So we are addressing that right now with Foss Maritime has that dock facility. That Shell Oil was going to use it last year, so they hurried up, got things together, got conditions present that it's usable. We're researching how much electricity we have available. We need 480 at 400 amps max to that vessel, and the ship loader alone down there has that kind of capability. So we're going to have some numbers that I think are going to be comparative to the Ketchikan pricing on it. The downside, again, the captain's correct, we have to have someone go over there and look at that boat at least, daily to make sure that it's fine. I agree with the wet layup, is what we're calling it, wet layup. I think that at this point is a good deal. I think that Seward probably gives us a very good opportunity. There's one other one, but I still feel that general public needs to see this vessel. So we're going to address those costs now and get it finite, but we do have concurrence with Foss today that, yes, they are interested in tying up. They have no other uses for that dock this winter. So that would get it a place to put it up here. And then, like I said, in the other 8 months of the year, put it at our own dock.
Assemblymember Culver, then Assemblymember Keel.
What's the timeline on transiting across the Gulf?
You pull your mic in.
What would be the, what's our window to transit the boat if it was to come to Seward? When would we need to make that decision by? I guess through the manager to whoever you point that question to.
The captain.
I'm trying to put my phone's ringing. Sorry about that. I thought I turned it off. So you're looking at the timeline. Well, you'd want to leave no later than, God, I wouldn't want to do it later than the middle of October. You'd want to be on the road by then.
Thank you.
Assemblymember Keogh, then Assemblymember Halter.
I have a couple of questions. So just for starters, to be clear, last meeting by a 5-2 vote, we decided to bring the Susitna up and dry dock it at Port Mac. Now it sounds like that option of dry docking is necessarily off the table because obtaining the necessary permit from the Corps is impossible. Is that through the mayor to the manager? Do I have that? Is that correct?
Almost correct. I would not say it's impossible, but it's pretty slim. So
it's fair. No time soon we're going to have a Corps permit necessary to for that, that option.
That's what I'm telling you. I do not believe we will have a Corps permit to make the trip up here during the month of October.
Okay. Well, I wanted to voice the opinion that I think we made a mistake by acting precipitously last meeting with very little information, with insufficient information about the costs, permitting, and so on. This is just one more wrong turn that we've made, in my opinion. So I have a question through the mayor to Captain Stormont. In your opinion, according to your email message, there are only two viable options right now. It's either sell the ferry or go for the wet layup. In the wet layup proposal or information that you have here, is that could be done in Ward Cove at a cost of about $210,000 a year in wet layup status versus the current cost of keeping it there for about $900,000 or so. Do I have that straight?
Yeah, that's true. My first option would be sell the vessel.
And you didn't list any third option, so sell it or wet layup. Is that pretty much it?
Gentlemen, I'm looking at the long term here. Ladies and gentlemen, pardon me. You don't have a ferry vessel. You have a high-speed craft ferry vessel. Totally different set of regulations. Det Norske Veritas covers that. ABS can do it here in the United States. Det Norske Veritas does the state ferries. I just retired from the state of Alaska Marine Highway. The last 6 years, captain on the Chinooka, the fast ferry, and the Fairweather. These are tremendously expensive vessels to maintain. You'd be better off building a ferry and getting rid of the high-speed craft one. You're going to find down the line that there's things that you can't control. It doesn't matter how many hours on the engine. They're going to say, how old is the engine? The BC ferries recently sold to a fella, Glenn Darling. I happen to know the vessels. I happen to know him. One of them had 88 hours on the main engines, but it's so old, 7 years old in layup. The rules are you have to have a complete tear down and a complete rebuild. So the thing that I don't like is you're talking like, well, we're going to keep it around for 4 or 5 years and then we're going to use it. If you're going to keep this vessel for 4 or 5 years, you're going to haul it out of the water and you are going to pull the engines out through the side because they can't come out any other way, and you are going to end up rebuilding this entire machinery. You've got the vessel was designed at 400 feet. It was built at 196. The engines aren't smaller. They're the same size. Everything is crammed into a small. You can't pull a cylinder out of there because it's too close to the overhead. You're going to have a lot of maintenance coming up, and you need to think about that in the future. I'm not saying that $2 million is all you're going to get for it, but the second best thing is a wet layup somewhere. Keep it in the water. Keep the engines running once a month. Keep the vessel functional. But you got to think ahead. It's going to be costly either way.
One follow-up question for Captain Stormont.
Okay.
And that is on the dry dock option that we went for last meeting. I've heard various suggestions on the cost to, if we do dry dock the vessel for a year or 2 years, the cost of, one, to put it back in the water, which that dollar amount wasn't shared last, but that was $615,000 for crews to put it back in the water. But cost in addition to that, I've heard estimates from $4 million to $10 million to get the vessel seaworthy and recommissioned. Is that an accurate number?
Well, actually, Mr. Cruz's proposal, they had MTU was going to do a complete preservation of the engines. After 2 years, you shouldn't have to do a complete rebuild. But this is a very arbitrary thing. This is up to whoever comes up here and inspects this vessel. And if they don't like what they see, if they don't like the fact that it's sitting out of the water, you know, you have no choice. So I can't really tell you what's going to happen. But even if you have to do a top-end rebuild, you're still going to have to take it back to Ketchikan, because right now that's the closest shipyard that can handle it. They're still going to pull it out of the water. They're still going to have to tear the engines out. And it's still going to be very, very expensive. The other thing is, the vessel's never been through an inspection. We've never had a real Coast Guard inspection. We've never had a COI done on it. You have some things on there that have to be addressed. One of them is the automated engine suppression system. That is required by the high-speed craft code. It's never been tested. We have, you know, you'll have to get people up here to do that part of it. You have a 10-centimeter radar that never did work, and at one time we had the fellow from Denmark over there at the shipyard to do it, and then we decided not to do it. You have several things right now that need attention. You'll also have to do a complete new set of sea trials, which means a crew and inspectors and stuff like that. It's kind of a little bit of a daunting task. It can be done. Yes, it can be done. You want a dollar figure on it? I don't know. I mean, the sea trials alone, it can cost $500,000 if they don't go right. What can I say? And then you still have to get it, you know, to get it certified, you have to have a crew on there. The Coast Guard is going to take you out. They want to see fire and boat drills. They want to see everything that happens. They want to see the fire system tested. These are all expensive things. Speaking of life-saving gear, you have the MES system on there, the chutes, the slides for passenger evacuation. Those have been out of date for 2.5 years. You don't even have a fire extinguisher on there that's in date right at this moment, and there's well over 100 of those. The life rafts have been out of date for over a year. The MES system alone, the last time I was on the Chinega and we had those repacked, it was $75,000 to repack two of them, and you have two. So there's a lot of little costs here that add up when you're talking about bringing this vessel into passenger-carrying service.
Assemblymember Halter, then Assemblymember Culligan, then Assemblymember Saul.
Well, how much is it?
You should pull your mic in.
How much would it take to, even what you're saying about a Ketchikan, how much does it cost to get, if somebody wants to come and test this boat, how much does it cost to get it back into running condition?
It's going to be in running condition if you do it in a wet layup. We're not going to preserve the engine.
So there's no additional cost to get it set up?
I think I estimated $12,400 to put it into a wet layup. That's 4 men, 4 days. You've got about $1,200 of that is going to be the sewage disposal. Yeah, that has to be flushed twice.
What do you think of Mr. Cruz's suggestion of bringing it up here? Obviously not this fall, I guess, but next spring.
In Seward? Well, the only thing I don't like about Seward is where it's at. That's the same side of the bay that the shipyard's on. In southerlies, heavy southerlies, you're going to get a good-sized wave in there. When there's a huge ship or a chip ship or something there, when you're looking at a 700 or 800-foot vessel, that's no big deal. But I was on the Tustamina for 20 years, and we broke lines at the ship dock there. So the thing that I like about Ward Cove is the fact that there is no sea. Yeah, the wind blows through there, but you don't get any, maybe a half a foot of sea.
What's the cost to run it up and back?
To run it up and back?
Well,
I estimated to begin with, I sent an estimate out to you folks not long ago of about $94,000, which $60,000 of that was fuel. In retrospect, I missed the mark. I had the fuel down to maybe 3,000 to 4,000 gallons upon arrival. That's not prudent. In October, the Coast Guard would take a dim view of me trying to come across the Gulf with a minimum amount of fuel. The other thing is I forgot to put in the plane tickets to get the crew back to Ketchikan. That's not but still, I mean, you're probably looking at, you know, $110,000 for me to get it up anyway.
One way.
One way. I don't know. I think you got a better rate on the with Olson Tugs.
Well, Mayor.
Sir.
If you tow it, it's about $144,000 to bring it up. It'd be $144,000 to take it back. Okay. If you drive it up, the captain's right, it's about $110,000 each way. So that's why we chose, and you know, plus it ain't going to look very good towing that thing down, you know.
No.
You know, it was really nice to see it come in under its own power.
So, Assembly Member Culligan.
So, you know, to dispense a little bit of the drama, we are here tonight listening to this stuff because we forced some decisions to be made. And we've asked for some tighter numbers and the like. We've had some different proposals come in. But we are only here tonight because we've asked and forced this decision to be made in the last several weeks. I am surprised that we haven't found out a year ago that we could keep it down there for $210,000 a year. That's kind of upsetting to start with. And I respect both of you coming here before us to kind of vet some of this information so we can make an informed decision. Mr. Cruz, you, what's the annual, have we figured out any annual cost to bring it up in sewer to keep it there or other opportunity to bring it? I mean, there's a cost to bring it back for it, but if we, versus $225,000 or $210,000 a year, what are the costs? Are we still kind of working those out, or where are we at?
Well, I think the considerations are the same cost that the captain has. The variable B for us, there is correct. There is, you know, you can have a nice winter, you could have a rough winter, but we have a certified dock to tie it up to. I just, with our boats, we just put more lines on them. Mm-hmm. But you do have to have someone down there watching it. So the only variable is getting the power, making sure that we can plug that boat in there to keep the heat on. Same thing they have. They already have that existing facility in there. So we priced it. We actually got down, I think the final number out at the port was $50,000. But when we first had electrical contractor look at it, it was about $110,000. But after working through the process with the naval architect that designed this vessel, we got it down to that price.
Okay, so with our annual cost to bring it up here and ferry it back and forth, we've got $110,000 each way plus the cost of wet layup.
If you take it to Ketchikan, you're $110,000. If you drive it up here, whether you bring it to Seward and tie it up, you're not coming as far, so it's going to be a lesser cost. You're not burning as much fuel. And then if you move it from Seward up to our dock in the summer, we would have to do a little bit of work on the dock because, again, you have to the tidal changes at Port McKenzie that we'd have to address. But it's not a million dollar problem. You know, we've tied our barges up out there and been able to. It's called slipping the lines, and they go up and down with the tide.
And what about the protected cove at Port Graham in the winter? There, have we looked at that or the capabilities?
Yes, we looked at Port Graham, but the dock is too small to tie it up there. Okay. We looked at Seldovia. We thought we had the deal that Homer was very, very affordable, but then they're basically maxed out in their harbor, and the fishing boats are taking precedence. The 100-foot fishing boats are taking precedence over us.
So at the end of the day, I guess where I'm at on this is that it sounds like we need a little bit more work and information to refine some numbers and come with some real proposals. It doesn't sound like we're going to hit our time frames that we're originally trying to do, other than if we're going to move it up here, we need to do it before mid-October. I think that's agreeable. But again, we're here having this discussion because several weeks ago we demanded to do something about it. And I don't feel bad about pushing those buttons. We need to do something. We need to have some direction and move forward. But I feel like we need some, I guess, manager, some refinement of these actual proposals of what the cost estimate costs are going to be, line item, and move forward.
Assemblymember Solomon.
First thing I would like to say is that I echo Assemblymember Culligan in that I don't believe we jumped the gun by making this decision. the proof is in the pudding. We had nothing after I've been on this assembly now for a year and 9 months. All of a sudden, like magic, we got Magnum numbers with Magnum options that came at us out of nowhere within the last month. And so the value maybe wasn't to get where we wanted to go or to know for sure, but we certainly got some activity. And so I applaud the Assembly for making the hard decision to push the envelope, and now we're at the edge of some concerted decisions to be made. And I was curious, Mr. Cruz, has the Port Commission weighed in on, not that it would matter to us, but have they weighed in on what they perceive would be the, or can you not speak for them, sir? Did they do a resolution or anything like that?
We did not do a resolution, but my recollection, we all have, I've lived on the Port Commission almost 9 years. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be done in December. So I watched this thing unfold. I listened to the salespeople come up that were telling me that how great this vessel was. I know that Captain Stormont is very, very experienced, but I know that there is also, if we do not have to operate as a fast ferry, and that's what I was sold on, that we could operate as a slow ferry, then these costs go down, you know, that what he's talking about. So I've lived this thing since its conception, and that's the frustrating part, that I really think that one of my biggest concerns, and I'll echo it right here, is we will have, when the railroad gets done, close to, is it $400 million in Port McKenzie? And Anchorage can't get there. Anchorage is the one that's going to drive that deal. They're going to move their warehouses over there. They're going to move all this over there. I feel that ferry is essential to provide the service that it was designed for, to go back and forth across Kinnick Arm and make that area grow. And we have seen now, since I've been sitting on the Port Commission and we've had a dock there, I have not seen enough traffic there to warrant what we're doing. So I feel that this ferry will add the value. When I started in business over 30 years ago, I didn't get to start with new equipment. I got to buy old junk and build up, and it wasn't perfect, and I kept doing it and doing it and doing it. Finally, I got something that was good. Well, you guys are getting to start with a $70 million boat. Is it the perfect thing? Is it going to run perfect? You know, the captain's probably right. There are going to be additional costs. But this is a public transit system that you have, and I feel it needs to be a state issue. And you have the two largest communities now, Anchorage and the Matanuska.
So in answer to my question, though, I've known how you feel for a long time. My question was, how does the commission feel? Are they in agreement?
I would not try and put words in anybody's mouth there. I would say that we go back to our next meeting and we'll have we will discuss this and have a resolution, and we will get it to the Assembly.
That would be good. And then the follow-up to that is, as I listened to the captain this evening, is it JP or JT?
John Paul.
That's what I thought. I was thinking JP, John Paul. Anyway, if I'm listening tonight here and I'm considering to buy the unit, after what I've heard, all of a sudden my hackles are up. I'm backing away, whether it's $2 million or five or ten. This is some disconcerting news about the cost of operation and what I can expect. And I don't know if, in the essence of full disclosure, if we're telling anybody that is interested in the unknown unknowns that they're staring in the face once they put their money down and take possession. So those are my only 2 points. I think I'm weighing on the Ward Cove wet dock right now from everything that's been presented to me, and that's only one vote, but that's how I'm leaning unless somebody says something dramatically different that can convince me differently. Thank you, sir.
That's what the process is all about. Assemblymember Colbert.
Well, I think we are doing good work because we felt the pressure of the cost of and just not making progress, and everybody here has had a hand at moving this forward, you know, especially Dave here, that we could not just sit in this holding pattern, you know, hemorrhaging cash. And so now we're already, you know, got proposals to save about $800,000 annually, which is huge progress. And
So I think we need to kind of refine and do more analysis. We've got a little bit more time now that the dry docking is off the table. So we've, you know, and our deadline now is, decision is, it's Seward or it's Ward Cove, it looks like to me. And so our trigger for that decision, we have probably a little bit more time, not much, but to refine those proposals, get them nailed down, and then make that final decision within the next week or two. Captain, if you could maybe elaborate, I appreciate your analysis on the M&O, the functionality of the vessel. I'm especially interested in your analysis, your professionalism, the limitations of that vessel. So you mentioned that due to the cost constraints, the ship was shortened, but still got the large engines. Can you kind of elaborate on what the functionality as far as using it for a ferry service as envisioned across Cook Inlet as a skipper of a ferry boat, is it functional for that? What are the limitations tying it up to the dock, the special kind of docks you have to have and all that, and the, I guess, the alignment as you bring the ship in to tie it up? Kind of, can you maybe hit on some of those issues, that the challenges that one would face to put that in service?
Yes. Really, if you have the docks on either side like they are designed, the boat will work. It was never made as a passenger carrying ferry vessel to operate in the barge mode and do beach landings. Your ferry boat part of it is barge up, intact, and row traffic coming over the bow and out the stern if you want. You'll need the infrastructure, you need the docks. It has to be built to accept that vessel. It's one of the reasons the vessel never had any capstans, any mechanical means of tying up. It was supposed to be on the dock. They hand the vessel the line, and they pull you up. If you had those kind of docks and that kind of access, there's nothing wrong with the boat. It's a fine vessel. 20 vehicles, that's, you kind of got a little deal there where your load limitation right now. Of course, this is all conjecture, basically, because we have never had a COI. We've never had an inspection. But right now, you're basically limited to a payload of 35 tons. Well, an Alaska, what they call an Alaska vehicle, is a pickup truck, not a Toyota something. You know, it's a heavier vehicle. Well, you can put, the deck is rated for 20 vehicles, and you can do that if they're just pickup trucks or something like that. But to put it in another perspective, 35 tons is one dump truck full of wet sand. I've weighed it myself. So there's your other, I mean, we had, you know, I've had Shell Oil down there. I took those guys out twice. And always when it came to the payload, that's what they were concerned with. It didn't work for them. But just carrying, you know, cars and pickup trucks over, or the occasional single load of a larger truck or something like that, that's fine. And the vessel's a good vessel. There's nothing, you know, and if you have the right docks, it'll work.
Thank you.
Assemblymember Woods.
Yes, a couple of things come up, and I'd like our manager to comment on the receptivity of the Anchorage people over there about putting a dock on their side, number one. Number two, I think there's been some estimates of a dock on our side to support that. Number three, we are obligated to spend some money on that thing because we accepted it. And that's, I'd like a dollar figure on that. And from there, I'd like to have another comment.
Mr. Manager, 1, 2, 3.
The first question has to do with the docks at the municipality of Anchorage or Port of Anchorage. Our latest plan is to avoid the Port of Anchorage and use the private company. It used to be Anderson. Is that correct? What's the name? What's the name? Who owns that now?
Ship Creek Point is owned by the railroad. The south point of the two points there at the public boat launch is where Cook Inlet Tugging Barge is located.
Okay. And so that is private. That is not the municipality of Anchorage. And we've had proposals. In fact, we have design for a ship landing on that side and also too at Port McKenzie. The costs are significant, and it was with this proposal that I was charged with. The plan would be is to go to Juneau and start requesting funding for the landings. The landings have to be there to make this work, and so we would begin right away making that request for fundings for the landings. We're estimating, I think Mark estimates, which is not Mark, P&D estimates, we're probably at the 2007 number, we were at $54 million for both. Is that correct?
It was Trick Nyman Hayes was our contractor. In 2007, their cost estimate for both landings was $44 million. And I used to use 10% a year, and less couple of years I've only been using 5% a year for increase in construction cost. And so their estimate was done in 2007, but it was projected to the middle of 2008. So it's been 5 years since then. And if we had the money today, the earliest we could build the landings would be 3 years from now. It would take 3 years to get all the work done before you could actually build them. And so 8 years times 5%, it'd be a 40% increase. So it would increase to over $61 million by the time we actually build them 3 years from now or more. Plus, the railroad requires the road upgrade for Ship Creek Point. That's another $7 million to upgrade, pave, add a sidewalk, and put lighting in is what they require. Plus, we'd have to relocate Cook Inlet Tugging Barge to another location elsewhere at the port, probably a couple million for that. So you're looking at $70 million plus a potential $3.5 million or more a year that you'd have to subsidize the ferry.
Well, what we have done for the past year is because it's our intention to sell the boat or find another entity to take, we have really not spent any time negotiating or talking about those costs or those options. If the direction I was given at last assembly meeting, we will need to go and do that and ferret out those costs and get some agreements. And it will, Mark is correct, it will take 3 years to go through the permitting process to do so. But I'm assuming it's going to take us a little bit of time to get some state bites on helping us with the landings. And your last point, Assemblymember Woods, was cost. And there are some costs associated with the boat that when there's a determination that we were going to sell it or have another entity use it, I informed FTA, and FTA at the time said that $6 million we have in balance in a grant, that until we had a full plan on landings on both sides, they were going to freeze those dollars. So what we did is things came up. The radar came up, replacing some of the equipment for passengers. We just put that on hold. And so I think the radar, we're looking at $35,000. We have some safety equipment for the public, such as life raft, life preservers. That's a few thousand bucks we need to add. But we just kind of stopped adding to the boat based upon the decision of the assembly to put it in somebody else's hands. So if it's the direction of the assembly to preserve it to use for future use, we will certainly go back and work on those items. We've not really spent much. We haven't spent any time in the last year on that mission.
I think you outlined my position perfectly. We can't afford that boat up here.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Halter and then Mr. Keel.
Well, Mr. Manager, I guess didn't we have some, what about a recent offer to buy this boat? What's the status of that?
We have, how best to say this, after the last vote, of the assembly, I think it was clear direction from the assembly that we work on bringing the Susitna up to Port McKenzie. And because of difference of opinions and that sort of thing, I want to make it clear to the assembly that that was our mission and our concern to find a way, get the cost to make that happen. So at that point in time, any discussions that we had with offers, we did not seek or entertain those because I wanted you to be sure that, you know, our direction was your direction on that. We did have an offer, unsolicited offer. I believe they sent that forward to you. The agreement is in the hands of the attorney. We don't think it's in that agreement that they sent signed is in perfect shape right now, but we do. You know, when we're lining all these things up, no matter what we do, there's some inherent risk. If we sell it for less than $6 million, then we have a conversation with FTA about that grant and how the difference in how much we sell it for and how much we own on the grant. We're going to have to seek some type of approval. They may or may not get it, give it to us. I have been trying for the last 6 months to get something in writing because they are very encouraging. They understand our situation, but when it comes to, hey, I need something for the assembly, put it in writing, they go back to the original agreement and quote that. So there is some risk no matter what we do, unless we can sell the boat for more than our obligation, and we've not been able to do that yet. So we do have an offer that's significantly less than $6 million we owe just on the ferry. It's not in perfect shape, but there might be some other opportunities as well. And that would be a question I have for the assembly. Is it appropriate for me and staff to, at the same time we're working on this, entertain offers to purchase the boat? And what's your appetite on less than what we owe, if any?
Well, Mr. Manager, I guess, you know, when I was looking at that issue at the last meeting, and I voted on to dry dock it, I think, you know, just because I thought we needed some movement. And I think Mr. Culligan summed that up pretty clearly. We got that. But I thought we were either going to keep it in the water and catch can, pending sale, or dry dock it pending sale. Sale was always our out. Either way. You know, I appreciate what Mr. Cruz is saying about the usage of it, but it just seems like the costs are so outrageous, we're never going to get there. And so I guess I've always thought we're on a sail, dry docking or in the water.
Yeah, the manager would like to. Yeah, I would like to respond to that. And when we have, I believe the previous vote was look at sail and dry docking together, that motion or the motion with the sail failed. And then it came back with the next motion on just bringing up and dry docking. I think with the no vote coupled with the yes vote, and I concluded that was our mission. That's been our mission, and that's what we worked real hard in, you know, past 10 to 12 days. And so we did not put any energy into to selling the boat based upon the no vote that was made before the yes vote. I'm starting to sound like John Kerry.
So, well, I guess I certainly didn't understand it that way, you know, myself personally, but I appreciate what you're saying there. But it doesn't make any sense to dry dock this boat for 3 to 5 years. I mean, what's the mission there?
My understanding is we would invest in that. We would preserve the boat and eliminate many of the future costs. Why we sought funding for the landings at the same time, trying to find a partner or someone to actually create a ferry service in the Cook Inlet. I think that was my understanding.
So it's the use as a ferry system.
Use in, yeah. I mean, it, to bring it up here without the end goal of creating a ferry service in a Cook Inlet, I don't see the practicality of that.
Okay, Assemblymember Keough.
Well, this last dialogue is right on point here. The essence of the question is, what is our end goal? Is it to sell the ferry, or is it to eventually bring it up here, whether we lay it up wet or we dry dock it, for the purpose of eventually operating it as a ferry? So in the last year, we've been in the mode of trying to sell it unsuccessfully. But if our goal is to operate it as a ferry, which I've consistently supported in the past, who's going to do that? I mean, it's clear that we can't afford to subsidize it to operate it as a ferry. To dry dock it, to me, seems absurd. So where is the entity that's going to step up to operate this as a ferry? It's not going to be us. We've approached the state in the past, the Alaska Marine Highway System, to assume ownership, or they've expressed disinterest several times. So if, as much as we might like to operate the Susitna as a ferry, who's going to do it? Nobody that I can see, which leaves us with the option of selling it. So if we're going to sell it, what's the best means to do that? And I have to reach the conclusion that the best way to do that is to lay it up wet in Ward Cove and continue the efforts to sell it. Is someone willing to step up and operate the boat? If they are, who are they? Where are they? I don't see them.
I've got a question for JP that I've never gotten answered, at least in a way that's stuck, and that is, why couldn't that ferry be recertified or decertified? Because our use never made any sense for it to be a high-speed ferry, just going back and forth. And I don't know how we got into the high-speed ferry business in the design and development, but is there a way to decertify that thing so that a lot of the expenses in that higher category go away?
Depending on what the findings are, you would be hiring a marine architect, some sort of company like that, design group. They need to look the boat over and make sure that you meet the standards for things like your bulkheads. Are they A60 bulkheads for 60 minutes of fire, you know, retardation, heat loss and stuff like that? It's basically a matter of making sure the construction is going to fit the other class of vessel, which is your subchapter H passenger carrying vessels, which the Marine Highway, that's what they have, except for their two fast ferries. You've got a company in Anchorage that can do that. They have to basically crawl all over the boat, check things, look at the general arrangements. I don't know how much it's going to cost. It isn't going to cost anywhere. I'd be surprised if it was $25,000. But they do have to go through page by page and stamp every one of them, okay, this is good, this is good, this is good. And at the end, you decertify the vessel. And, you know, then you have something, a regular sort of a ferry vessel. The problem is with that one, it's already been constructed as a high-speed craft. You're probably going to have high-speed craft crew to operate it. They won't have to have, I don't believe they'll have to have a high-speed craft endorsement, but it's a hard boat to operate. You're not going to get anybody to do it. I mean, you know, you have to have some sort of certain knowledge of high-speed craft. But, yeah, you can decertify it.
Hmm. Well, thanks. That's the first time I've gotten that answer. Assemblymember Solomon.
Tired of talking about it, and I'd like to move on to the next agenda item unless there's going to be some kind of action taken. Everybody's had a chance to speak, and I'm not sure I'll get anything more out of listening to anybody else.
Well,
just my thought.
I guess the manager made one question that I'd want answered if I was the manager. Can he move ahead on offers on the ferry? I'd like each of you to speak to that.
Direct the manager to move ahead with sale and have a vote on it so he knows what he's facing.
And that's ditching everything else or alongside of it?
Keep it in Ketchikan and direct the manager to sell it.
Okay, that's a motion. Assemblymember Colligan?
Just to be clear, I'd like to propose to amend that so that we also include the wet layup and refining the further numbers. I think we need to consider, have them prepare those if we're going to make it, just, those things need to move and play. I don't think it would be, I want to make sure that our direction is that those things need to be finished. Those things need to be identified. We need to look at those alternatives. So I would make that amendment that we also proceed with Mr. Cruz's.
Okay, we've now formulated our motion. Mr. Manager.
Can I get a clarification, I think maybe from Dave or JP, if we put this in wet layup or reduce and we do have someone that says, hey, I want to take this boat out because I want to make an offer or I've made an offer that I think somebody's going to accept, I know it's different from what we're doing now. How difficult is it going to be? I want the assembly to know how difficult it's going to be in one state and actually take it out for a potential buyer.
My feeling on that is let them pay for it. If you're going to discount a $70 million boat to $6 million, I'm going to get my pocketbook out and I'll pay for the thing to do a trial on it. There's no reason you have to continue to at that pricing. So I would feel that buyer beware, you know. You want to try it? You want the discount? Go out and run it.
We ask to use the restroom first before we leave?
What's that?
So could you ask if they use the restroom before they leave?
That's right. Done all the time.
Okay. Let's clarify the motion. First of all, there's a motion to wet dock it in Ketchikan.
And what was your third?
So we have two options here. We have the wet layup in Ketchikan. We have asked for we need to refine some numbers on bringing it up here. That's not done. I want some firm numbers on wet layup. And I think the direct is to look at the offers as well. I know that's...
Mr. Van Dongen.
Besides the option to sell, we should also retain the option to transfer to a qualified government agency where we wouldn't be selling it. Just a point of order.
Well, we're getting a little bit informal here, but...
Maybe the manager restate the motion how he understands it, and then we can be clear on it.
Yeah, Mr. Manager, how do you understand this?
I understand that this is a four-headed beast. I am to look at sales, at the same time nail down the numbers on keeping it Ketchikan in a wet-dry state or wet layup state. Also to... the Seward / Port McKenzie option, get a cost for that, or transfer it to a qualified government agency that would de-obligate us from FTA.
So just do everything at once.
Basically. Let's deal with that.
Mr. Woods.
If I read the manager's remarks correctly, why we will put that in the cheapest wet docking facility in Cordova or in Ketchikan. Is that correct?
Unless Seward is cheaper. but what if before we move the ferry, I'm chicken. I want your approval before I do anything with this. So if we're going to move it, I'm coming back to the assembly and say, this is the deal that we got. I want your blessing.
Yeah, I think we would expect that.
I don't think we should add the stuff about the extra cost for bringing the boat up here at this point in time. I think we ought to just keep the motion simple and keep it at wet dock in Ketchikan, pending sale, which would include a transfer to another government agency. I've never disputed that. So just keep this a very simple motion. If somebody else wants to make a different motion, depending on the outcome of this one, they can.
Okay, you're the motion maker. So Assemblymember Colligan.
Along that lines, we already have a contract to determine some of those costs. I think it's prudent for us to figure out what that alternative is. We're already halfway there. I think it's prudent for us to figure out what those differences are.
A memo on the cost.
But I think under contract, we're already kind of looking at those, and I think we should finish that thought, document it, and move on. That's.
Let's vote on that. That's well, wait a minute. We've got, if you want that, you need to amend it.
I would move the secondary amendment, Halter's amendment, with the manager's language. That would be my secondary amendment. To be clear.
Well, I'd like the clerk to read it back.
Yes.
Oh, boy. I am sorry, Mr. Mayor. I cannot repeat back with
okay,
the
well, Mr. Manager, outline your four tracks.
Who's on first?
And this is the amendment.
I don't know, but what's on second? I believe my direction from assembly is...
No, we're making a motion, so... We're asking you to verbalize what you just did prior to this.
We're going to... It's going to hang out in Ward Cove. We're going to look at the reduction of costs, the wet layup in Ward Cove. Bring those numbers back. Bring the wet layup numbers for Seward to us. Keep options open for sale. Keep options open for transfer to another entity, qualifying entity.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the motion.
Okay, that's
my
the,
secondary amendment. To,
that's the amendment to the... Simple primary amendment. So, we're ready for the question. Is there objection to that?
Could you please restate the amendment? We have a... I'm sorry, this has been a very awkward discussion on this. So we have a primary motion by Assemblymember Halter, followed by an amendment by Assemblymember Colligan. So we're voting on the amendment by Assemblymember Colligan.
Assemblymember Culver.
Culver. What it,
so the primary motion was a simple motion to wet lay it in Ketchikan and pursue sale.
Which included a transfer to another government agency.
Which includes transfer to another government agency. That's the simple main motion. We add to that then your three items.
Seward,
so this is the amendment.
Cost and Seward.
Cost and Seward.
Keep it open for offer.
Keep it
for what? Purchase. Somebody buy it.
Well, that's already there.
That wasn't part of the original motion. And then to keep it open for it to be transferred. The original motion was to keep the ferry in Ketchikan and do the wet layout. That was the original motion. Culver's secondary amendment added those three items I just said.
Just point of order, my recollection is the primary motion included the sale of the vessel.
Yes, I'm sorry. You're right.
So they're all in there, everything.
Yeah. Okay, we ready? Is there objection to the amendment? Thank you.
Amendment.
No objection. So, the primary motion amended. Any objection to that? Hearing none.
passes. Thank you. Moving on. AM 13123. Assemblymember Halter, you want to make that motion?
And Mr. Mayor?
Madam Clerk?
I want to move to continue this to...
We need to read it into the record.
Okay. The main motion is already on the floor, but I will read it into the record also. Award of bid number 14016B, Caswell Lakes Road Upgrade to Western Construction and Equipment, LLC, for the contract amount of $2,180,753.10.
Mr. Halter.
I want to move this to continue to the next assembly meeting because, first of all, I think, Mr. Jensen, the number is
but
less.
You need to move it first.
I'll move to continue this to the next assembly meeting.
Yeah. And
the reason for that is I think the number's wrong. I think the real number is $1.6 million. The amount, the road they're going to do is not the total loop that they planned on up there. And I would really like to have a chance to talk to the Caswell Road Board now and see what they're thinking on this. They're going to move some of their own personal road service area money in here just so they could meet this bid. I'm not really objecting to that. I think Mr. Jensen says they're not really feeling like they'd want to construct it this fall anyway, so there's not a time-sensitive thing. And quite honestly, I think we're only getting about a third of what the voters voted on at the most with this, which I'm a little worried about. So I'd like to talk to Caswell Road Service area and find out.
Okay. The motion to postpone time certainly September 16th.
Right.
Meeting.
That's final.
17th.
I don't think
is there objection to that? Hearing none? That takes care of that. And we've had audience comments. We've had other comments. If there's no objection, we'll adjourn.
I do too.
Okay. Mr. Colligan.
So earlier we had some testimony from Butch Moore. I just wanted to ask the question and figure out how we're going to address that. I've heard and discussed, and my recollection is what the documents put forward, that we agreed that we were going to build a road and put in the berm. We had discussions about noise and trying to address some of our gravel pit issues, et cetera. Had that discussion. He's provided the documentation that some things through stat, however it happened, what at least I remember, and I hope it's on the record, that we were improving that road and building that berm. There's also, we staked the property incorrectly, and I think that he had to go out and improve. But I'd like to figure out what the resolution is to that, and before the contractor pulls out of there, we provide some assurances that we're going to do what we originally, at least in our meeting, promised and committed to do. And I don't know how we're going to figure that out, but I'd like to know.
That is my intention. That's my plan. It will be done. However, the ordinance is different than that, and we're going to have to come back and amend that ordinance. The ordinance does not, nor does the plan say anything about the road, but it requires a full berm, which really does not make any sense. So we can get agreement that will solve the problem, but it will have to, at the end of the day, it will have to come back to the assembly for approval.
So is it correct, though, from the documentation, from the audio, from the meeting, I believe it was that was part of the ordinance. When it was written up, it is not. Is that your recollection? Or
the
not?
The presentation to the assembly and a planning commission discussed the road. However, when the ordinance came back, it did not. So, yes and yes.
So, if you could, I guess I would have been lawyered up a long time ago, but the reality is, can we provide him something in writing or commitment,
yes,
some resolution to, I don't know, it needs to,
yes,
be resolved.
I will resolve it, and I've been working with him the last couple of days on this, but I think he wanted to make the point.
Is there any, Mr. Manager? You have,
yes, this evening I would like to introduce our new Public Works Director, Terry Dolan. He's sitting next to George. He started yesterday, and we're happy to have him on board.
Yeah, we've been needing you. Are there any comments? We technically had our comments, except staff didn't get a chance.
You've got. I'll be out of town chaperoning an overnight field trip with my child's school. I won't be here next Tuesday for the joint meeting with the school district. Doesn't look like there's a lot on. Mr. Ashenbrenner will be here.
Okay. Madam Clerk. No further comments. We're adjourned.